So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Review Man.
Oh my God. Look at this. It is an absolutely awe-inspiring structure. We are told the outer structure is 20 feet tall. The inner structure is 16 feet tall. And on top of the structure, there are these spikes, much like you'll see razor wire to keep people from coming out of the prisons. That's what those spikes are for. You see them right there. Keep people from getting out over the top of this structure.
This is something you can prison King Kong in. You can't stick two men in this.
Gentlemen, this is the first ever Punjabi prison match. And the rules of the match are as follows. The interior structure consists of four doors, each one attended by a referee. Each door will be raised when called for by a competitor. The door will remain open for only 60 seconds. The outer structure has no doors whatsoever. So the only way to win the Punjabi prison match is by escaping both structures.
It's the Rock in the building. Khalid. Ramel. Pharrell in the house. Yes. Live from the United States. Brooklyn, New York. It's your boy. Yo.
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting coming at you on this Wednesday morning. How are you doing today, Wei?
Doing well. Pretty well.
What a week.
Huge week. You mean the last week or this one?
Just everything.
Every week is a big week.
Did you see Batman this past weekend?
I did not.
I did not end up seeing it either.
So are we still going to talk about it?
Well, I have heard rumors the Pope is not in it.
I have too. So no wonder they didn't, you know, push anything on TNA.
It would have been even more funny now if they had promoted it. And then Pope, like, was so excited and he went to go watch it and finds out he did not make it into the 2 hour and 45 minute edited version of the film.
I feel bad for him. I feel bad that, you know, he must come across like he's a little embarrassed after all this, you know? Telling everybody that you're going to be in this new movie, and then all the people go in to tune in, and you're not there. As somebody who, you know, does some editing, I feel bad anytime we interview people.
And they ask, when's my interview airing, yeah. Or it's cut down to 20 seconds.
Or that due to some legal issues, we can't air the interviews at all. That's the worst.
That happens.
Yeah, it does, and it sucks.
Yeah, it does. I remember one person who I kind of know. And he did a guest spot on Dexter, and he's just going on and on about my episode airs tonight, catch it. He's just plugging and plugging, and I guess it was apropos, but it got cut by Dexter.
Well,
I got to ask you, though, Wei, with the shooting that occurred last Friday, I guess late Thursday night for the midnight screening, does it deter you at all from going to see Batman? Because they project that it was down $20 million based on what they had projected. It still did very, very well, like $165 million, but some people, I guess, were scared.
Well, I don't think that people were actually, you know, necessarily scared, because really that was a freak occurrence. And if you're scared about something like that, I find it kind of ridiculous. I think what deterred people was probably the mood that, you know, that they were put in as a result of that whole thing. You know, like, now, like, people are calling these the Batman shootings, and does that necessarily make you want to go and enjoy a 2.5 hour movie knowing that, you know?
Yeah, I just don't know. Like, I personally, I just didn't have time to go see it this past weekend, but nor was I dying to go watch movie either.
Bad choice of words.
Okay, I was not trying to make a connotation there, but nonetheless, I was not looking forward to going to a movie this past weekend. It was I could take a weekend off of going to a movie theater.
Yeah,
I mean, you're gonna have that in the back of your mind the whole movie.
Yes, but
what if there's gonna be a copycat killer?
What? Come on.
Listen.
In the specific screening of the film in your city?
Listen, Toronto has not exactly been immune to shootings of late way.
Yes, yes, granted. But still, I just find that you have a better chance of winning the lottery, I think.
Well, everyone wins the lottery every now and then, and I did not want to
win the lottery
on the weekend.
No, no, not everybody.
Well,
we will talk about Batman once we both see it, I assume.
Yeah, we can talk about it next week when we both... You're planning to see it this weekend?
I'm going to watch it next Tuesday, I think.
It's 2 hours and 45 minutes.
Well, all movies are that long now. The Avengers was that long. I think Spider-Man was that long, too.
No, so Spider-Man was like... Yeah, it was over two.
Yeah.
It's like, man, when you're hitting that 2.5 hour mark and you're not moving, like, I can't move... I can't get up to get, like, a beer.
Wait a second. You're used to this every single week on multiple...
No, completely different way. When I'm at home watching a pay-per-view or something like that...
Or Raw. Yeah.
I can get up, I can move, I can get food, I can drink beer. In a movie theater, I'm, like, confined to this chair where you feel the need that I can't leave to even go pee during this movie because I'll miss something. There's no rewind button. There's no pause. So you are stuck here for a long period. I honestly cannot go to a movie unless I look up ahead of time how long it is because I have to mentally know how long I will be sitting here.
Yeah.
I cannot, it's painful for me to be there not knowing when a movie's going to end. I need to know.
The peeing is definitely an issue. Maybe they should bring back intermissions during movies.
Yeah, that would not be the worst idea.
They would sell some popcorn like they do at wrestling shows.
Like, they sell you these gigantic things of pop. Like, I don't buy pop when I go to the movies, but when I can imagine, that's a big problem for people to take one of those fucking extra large guzzlers. Yeah. And get through a 2.5 hour movie?
I'm all for intermissions.
It'd be nice. Give you a chance to chat with other people, make friends. Well, what do you think's going to happen?
That sounds like a good idea. Anyway, maybe they should do an intermission for Raw, you know?
That would be fantastic. I usually call it the Divas match, but...
Oh, yes.
An official intermission on the USA Network.
Yeah.
That would be nice. Though it would probably get annoying if you've PVR'd it or something. You're just...
It would certainly cut out a large chunk of time that we would have to watch.
How long will these 3 hour Raws last, Way? Based on Monday night's show, which I think we can all agree was a very entertaining show, albeit some.
Do you honestly feel that it will negatively impact the ratings that much?
I think it's going to take a while. Like this week, throw this week's rating out. I think this week is an anomaly. We are not getting shows like this every week where there was genuine interest. I mean, Monday morning, people were buzzing about this. There were people here at the office asking us about Raw. That never happens.
Although if the rating is poor, that's something you can look at.
Yeah, but we've seen the numbers come out, and I think they're pretty happy with what,
what that's
happened.
I
think long-term way, absolutely. I think you're going to have a problem with... Either people tuning in late and just 9 o'clock is when they're conditioned to watch wrestling, and even knowing it starts at 8, I think that's early for people. I mean, Impact had some trouble getting people to tune in an hour early, and it wasn't for a 3-hour show. I think people, 2 hours is a good amount of time for any show. I don't think any television show should be longer than 2 hours, ever.
2 hours is a bit too long. I mean, 90 minutes is really the ideal.
Well, when we had a... Part one of our interview with Court Bauer, he was mentioning to us that him and Vince talked about the perfect length for a wrestling show is 90 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
90 minutes is enough time to leave people wanting more at the end. I can tolerate 2 hours because I've been used to it for so long that 2 hours at times can drag, but typically it's the 3 hour shows that are just like, my God, once we're at segment 3 and you realize we still have 2 hours and 15 minutes to go here, those are the ones that are just tough.
My prediction, I think they're definitely going to go through the summer with this. I could even say maybe an hour. Maybe a year they will proceed with this 3 hour deal. I mean, how long did it take WCW to drop the 3 hour show?
They went to 3 hours in January of 98, and it was a full 2 years. It was January of 2000 when they moved back to 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, for WWE, it's going to be tough on a number of fronts because, A, you're more profitable doing this third hour. There is more money coming in. Without any extra production costs or anything else. Those are all fixed costs that they have for a shoot.
Well, yeah.
And they have all this extra money coming in. Second is that that first hour, I mean, advertising rates, it's all USA Network that benefits from the advertising. WWE, again, gets a fixed amount for the advertising that USA sells. So for WWE, it's almost just saving face by continuing this after we've made such a big deal out of this. And I just don't see the WWE looking at all these financial benefits but saying, well, we're burning out our audience. We should really taper back here.
They should, though.
They should, but I see them being very stubborn about this, and it's going to take a lot. I think it will take USA making the decision that, listen, NCIS reruns were doing higher than that first hour of Raw, which is dragging you guys down. But it'll be interesting to see how many fans convert over and become 3-hour viewers every week. If they can get, you know, of their 5 million, give or take, they do every week. I mean, I don't know if half those are going to be able to sit through 3 hours every week. That's an incredibly long period of time to ask people to watch every week.
It is. But people get conditioned quickly. I don't know. I feel like wrestling fans, there's always going to be that group that'll watch anything that this company puts out. And I think you definitely have those people. It's really about the casual audience, how much of the casual fans are going
to. Well, you have
around.
A good gauge of the casual audience because you had two of your friends come over and watch Raw, including Gordon.
Yes, Gordon will be watching. He did come over on Monday.
He's going to be watching every week?
No.
Is that what you were going to say?
No, I don't think he will.
What did Gordon think overall? Was it is he a regular pay-per-view watcher? Is he kind of, when it's hot, he'll watch and usually he'll skip?
I don't think he even knows about anything, although his dad watches from time to time. His dad's not a regular viewer. If he passes by it when he's channel surfing, he'll stick to it. But Gordon used to be a fan, but now he just... he hears us talk about it. Me and my friend talk about it a lot, and sometimes he tunes in, but otherwise...
I now want to hear your dad and Gordon's dad.
Oh, wow.
Come on the show.
Sure, and have them...
We're creating a lot of future guests here. When we have Gordon on eventually, I think it's going to be a big deal. That's when we'll do a 3-hour podcast.
Wow, okay.
Yes, with Gordon.
Right. Sure.
But Gordon's doing well?
He's doing okay, yeah. It's weird, because I don't think he really knows that we talk about him.
Well, I went to go add him on Facebook. I couldn't find him.
Oh, he goes by his Chinese name.
Oh, I went to your profile and then searched in your friends for Gordon. There was no Gordon.
Yeah.
It's like, maybe he's one of those weird cats that doesn't have Facebook or deleted it.
Yeah.
I was going to go post our video blog.
It's which one?
Oh, the one where we talked about him last week.
The Ask Away. It's just kind of weird that we are, broadcasting a discussion about this guy, and yet...
He has no idea at all.
It's kind of creepy.
He's becoming this review-away celebrity.
It's a little creepy, is it not?
No, it's not creepy. We're talking about people we know. Okay. I chat about my friends every now and then.
Okay.
My friend Paul is in Las Vegas right now.
Oh,
he was stunned that I hated potato chips. He said, I've known you for 10 years. I never knew this about you. So it's like we're also providing new information to old friends.
I think you should stop talking about your friends, John.
I have very few. I won't lie.
Are your friends like DX? Are you guys like DX? You all?
Yeah, we with Gordon, Sheldon, the hockey scout, and Eddie. Woo! One of the best calls in law history.
I got
you haven't
two
heard
words
it,
for you. Hung up.
A great call. That's worth the download right there of this past Sunday's edition of The Law, folks. Check it out. A great phone call from Andrew in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We've got a big show ahead here, Wei. We're going to be joined
We've killed enough time.
I think people enjoy this.
Yeah.
I think they want...
I feel like we should set a certain length of time for our pre-review banter.
No, you can't organize and map out.
I have to feel that there are many people that don't care about, what we have to say, and they just fast forward to the review every week.
And that's their option.
Right.
They're able to do that.
But maybe we can help those people.
No, I'm not gonna say, Wei, I'm going to talk to you as my friend for 5 minutes and 16 seconds, and then we've got to move on. I want to know what's going on in your world.
All right, okay.
Me and Wei do not talk unless it's on the air.
We don't even look at each other.
No.
Wait, John says,
leave me alone.
I gotta.
We will play ping pong every now and then.
We do, and you
pretty heated a ping pong game up on Touch right now.
That's right.
We're up to 100 followers. Way very exciting.
More so by this point, I am assuming.
At this point, I would say so.
Let's make a bold prediction. What do you predict your Touch numbers to be at this time, at the time of this posting, Wednesday morning?
I am going to say that Wednesday morning, we are going to have 130 followers on Tout.
I'm going to say we're going to have 200.
200?
I think we're going to double our Tout followers.
I think if something comes through on... Okay, fuck it. It's Monday morning, folks. If something comes through tonight on Raw, I think we could have a gigantic follower.
That's what I'm thinking.
We'll see.
Thinking a lot of people.
We'll see what happens.
You'll be touting all day. You'll be touting every week now. Every show.
Dude, I enjoy Tout. Like, legit enjoy it. And yeah. I have people on Twitter telling me, you sold Tout, you sold Tout. That's what someone chanted at
That's
me on,
funny.
On Twitter. And
you sold Tout.
You sold Tout. I loved it. I retweeted it. And other people saying they've lost respect for me because of Tout. Like, listen, I don't give a fuck if the WWE has an ownership of this. I enjoy this, and I think it has a decent chance of taking off. It's a perfect length of a video. I enjoy sending these out. And I think Tout has an honest chance of being a secondary social media device. I don't think it's of the Twitter level. But I think in terms of an Instagram level, maybe.
I think that the true value of Tout remains to be seen. I feel like if there's an actual instance that calls for a visual to be seen, you know, maybe if there's a riot going on, you know, Tout would be great for a riot.
Yeah, you're totally right. Yeah. Absolutely. For stuff that is visual, like ping pong games and Wei's lunch, Jamaican curry.
Mm-hmm. Chinese.
Oh, I'm sorry. Chinese curry.
Yeah.
That is stuff that you can only watch. You can't accurately communicate things like that.
Totally.
So coming up on today's show, Wei, we're going to be joined by Court Bauer, part two of our chat. On Monday, we had part one of our chat discussing Raw 1000, Batista fighting, lots of current topics. And then today, we're chatting Great American Bash 2006 with the former SmackDown writer, Court Bauer. Then we are also going to hear from Dan Lavransky, Jason Agnew, and Dave Meltzer's conversation the night of this pay-per-view.
Is that right?
From July 23rd of 2006. And on top of that, if I can find it, and this is a big if, we're going to have Big Show discussing the Punjabi prison match when he appeared. His one and only appearance on The Law.
Wow.
Where we talked about the Punjabi prison. So a loaded show, Wei.
Stacked.
Yeah, loaded. This is like Raw 1000, where everything's going to be a blur by the end of this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you have to look forward to. Great American Bash. Wei, an event that was this your first time watching this event, even though you were call screening for us, but you were still choosy back then about watching pay-per-views.
No, I mean, for the early part, and I'd say for the most part, I would show up, but I think I would fall asleep a lot of the time.
You are a sleeper, definitely.
Yeah, I would fall asleep while I was watching the pay-per-view with you guys, and so I wasn't really following too closely. I would always, you know...
For the Punjabi prison.
Yeah, even for the Punjabi prison. So I don't remember any of this.
So this was, as I mentioned, July the 23rd of 2006 from Indianapolis, Indiana. This was a SmackDown-only pay-per-view when we had the brand split. It was much more defined at this stage. They did the annual drafts, and this was about 3 years into the brand-specific pay-per-views. And I think this was a period of time where SmackDown had a really interesting roster. A lot of good workers. You had JBL, who had just moved to commentary. This was his first pay-per-view he was calling with Michael Cole. But this pay-per-view was like the UFC 149 of pay-per-views for the WWE, because the wellness policy had been instituted earlier in the year, and they had all these guys go down with they had elevated liver enzymes, which took the Great Khali out. Kid Cash and Matt Hardy had apparently just been suspended for failing, but did work this show. On top of that, Bobby Lashley could not compete on this pay-per-view as advertised. Mark Henry had just blown out his knee and could not work Batista on the show. So tons of reshuffling. Chris Benoit was on a hiatus. He had just gone home. They had given him the summer off. So they were somewhat depleted just in terms of guys, you know, just being taken off the roster or just not being available for this show.
What are elevated liver enzymes? How does one suffer from that?
I really don't know.
Liver enzymes.
It's
not something you hear about today.
No, it's never something you hear about with any athletes. Elevated liver enzymes. There was a fear at the time that it had something to do with like a hepatitis outbreak, the fact that you were having these liver issues.
Huh.
But it was very strange because the guys were generally back pretty quickly after this, and it was more precautionary method than anything, rather than putting guys in the ring that have what could be a severe liver problem. But maybe I will ask Dr. Margaret Goodman on the MMA report this week. She is the president of the Voluntary Anti-Doping Association, and maybe I'll ask her about elevated liver enzymes.
Yeah.
And we can get to the bottom of the causal effects of liver enzymes. You've never had elevated liver enzymes,
not that I know of, though I've never been tested. I've never been tested for TRT, anything.
But you could have low T.
I could.
That'd be awesome if you got a therapeutic use exemption for editing.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
I'd love to try it. I've mentioned it before. I'd love to try steroids.
Have you ever done excessive weight cutting or had head trauma?
Excessive weight cutting, maybe not,
on purpose.
Yeah. But no.
All right. Well, let's get into this pay-per-view, this cursed pay-per-view, which was to feature the first ever Punjabi prison match. And the opening video was built around the land of opportunity and the great Kali facing the Undertaker. So despite the fact that news had been leaked about the great Kali, they were moving forward with the Punjabi prison match as advertised. And apparently of all the wellness failures and the liver enzyme issues, Vince McMahon was upset over one name being leaked, and that was the Great Khali, which Dave Meltzer reported on, and he was just furious because the Great Khali is a monster. He cannot have health problems. So that was his biggest upset issue he was upset over. But the highlight of this video package was King Booker and Rey Mysterio with the Pollock versus Ting theme bed underneath it.
Yes, yes. For those of you who don't know, John and I, for our birthdays many years past, we edited promos, like UFC-style promos. And if you just go on YouTube, type in Pollock versus Ting, a lot of you have already seen it. But yeah, the track that I used for one of the videos was actually an NFL Films soundtrack, and that's apparently what the WWE used as well for this promo.
Did we get clearance for that song from the NFL?
No, we didn't.
I'm sure the WWE did. It's got to be some public domain track if WWE's using it. I've heard this used at Leaf games,
too. Actually, at the Fight Network, we have a license to air NFL Films music. That's the best music for promos. So I'm sure they have a deal.
So the sponsor for tonight's show, WWE Mobile, which I guess never really took off.
Yeah,
this was like an app before apps were around, I guess.
You could download your favorite entrance themes
There was a guy at O'Grady's who did that, and he would always
show it off.
He would get his WWE news alerts when we were there, and then he'd come over and tell me news that I had written about in my update earlier that day.
You can get wallpapers, superstar wallpapers.
Oh, amazing. So yes, WWE Mobile. They were doing a big push back here when mobile rights were such a big thing, and I honestly never felt like at that time, 6 years ago, I just didn't feel that watching videos on your phone was really going to take off. I just felt it was so weird because I had an iPod video at the time, and I never put video on my iPod. It's like, because I'd be walking. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be watching something, but then the iPhone came along, and I think the iPhone changed everything because the iPhone got it right.
Yeah, well, the iPhone really is not just... You can't look at it as a mobile device. It's really a computer that you can fit in your pocket. So it really, we're not going to get into a big discussion about the technology here, but the difference for me as a consumer was that those like things like the WWE mobile, they constricted what you could access to that mobile service, whereas with an iPhone you can get anything that you would be able to get on the internet on a desktop computer or a laptop.
So our announcers, as I mentioned, Michael Cole and JBL, and throughout the show I felt the two had clearly just begun together, and I felt they were a bit awkward together, and they were still trying to find their chemistry together, which they would find, and I really would enjoy these two. But I thought tonight, doing their first pay-per-view together, it was just JBL. I always remember when he first became the color commentator. It took him like a month to get out of... heel promo mode and into heel color commentator mode. And he made the stride very quickly. But this was, I mean, he was like 3 weeks into it here at the time we were watching this.
Yeah, I was watching.
Maybe longer than that, because it was, I think it was like May or so that he moved over. So
I was watching this pay-per-view and I was thinking, you know, from what I've seen of JBL's commentary work in the past, I remember just being really high up on it. Whereas watching this show, there's clearly something lacking, whether it be him being too overbearing in his commentary or just being too over the top.
And they kind of got into a good role where it was almost like JBL would be the bully to Cole and then Cole would kind of take it and stuff. In this, it was like Cole was like firing back at him, and it was just JBL, I think, didn't even know how to really get the flow going, so to speak. And it was just, I mean, they weren't bad by any stretch, but it was just certainly not,
not
what they would be evolve into.
Yes.
We started things off with the Pitbulls. Gary Wolf and Anthony Durante. No, this was the other Pitbulls, the non-ECW Pitbulls. Brian Kendrick, sorry, Kid Cash and Jamie Noble, whose gimmick appeared to be white rednecks.
But they wore the collars. They wore the Pitbull collars as they walked to the ring.
Yes, as well as having Confederate flags on their trunks.
Right. I didn't really understand this gimmick. Or did they start out in the new ECW? By the way, the new ECW had just begun.
Begun the prior month. You're right. I really cannot give you a great answer to that. I think they started in ECW, but might have been on SmackDown.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. They were challenging Brian Kendrick and Paul London, who were the tag team champions. And London and Kendrick come out almost in like these anonymous masks.
Yes.
Yeah, they came out in these weird masks. And JBL complains about non-English commentators being here in Indianapolis. So he was kind of the spokesperson for Kid Cash and Jamie Noble here.
Oh, right. Yes.
They note that the Pitbulls have never lost a barroom brawl. And JBL puts over tag team wrestling, saying, "I was part of one of the greats." With Farouk, one of the greats.
Yeah.
Right up there with the Rock and Roll Express, Dick Murdoch and Dusty Rhodes.
Always pounding ass.
Ray Stevens, Pat Patterson. Always pounding ass. And London launches Kendrick off the top for a crossbody and near fall. JBL brings up Jim Crockett starting the Great American Bash and how Crockett owes him money. The babyfaces clear the ring and do this celebration right out of 1985 and then do a double suicide dive to the heels on the floor. JBL says that heels are like being on the road without your wife. It's only cheating if you get caught.
Wow.
Great advice. JBL says that Paul London was trained by the Funks and Ivan Putski, which I think was inaccurate. I was always of the impression London got his start at Shawn Michaels' school with Rudy Gonzalez.
I thought so too, but maybe he had more training than that.
I don't know what he got out of Ivan Putski.
But those Shawn Michaels guys, they weren't fresh in, right? Didn't they all have some type of training beforehand?
I think Bryan Danielson started from scratch.
Oh, really?
I think so. London goes to skin the cap, but Noble drop kicks him in mid-transition, and he just lands back first onto the floor. And then the heels work on London, keep him away from Kendrick. London finally gets to the corner, but Noble pulls Kendrick to the floor at that point. And we continue onwards here. London blocks a brainbuster, and Kendrick comes off the top with a sunset flip, and London with the dropkick assist, and the babyfaces get the win. 13 minutes and 17 seconds, a really fast-paced opener. And JBL says that they may burn out because of their style, but enjoy them while they last in relation to Kendrick and London.
Sure.
And he was
kind
of accurate there, because here we are 6 years later, and not because their bodies have broken down, but the two hard to find these days.
What's up with Paul London? What's going on?
Paul London just kind of got burned out on the business. He was like trying his hand at comedy and stuff. You don't hear him doing anything, really. Jamie Noble is a producer with WWE, and Kid Cash is pulling knives out on guys and on Impact. So that's where everyone is today.
But yeah, this was a good match. I mean, basically a babyface high flyers versus some mat-based heels.
Good opener, I thought.
Good opener, but I suppose I didn't care at all about any of these participants.
We're in the back, and Daivari, who is the handler for the Great Khali, when they're articulate, you're a manager. When they're a monster, you're their handler.
Oh, right.
And Khali is going to call out The Undertaker right now, and Daivari is telling him to wait for the match, and he just lifts Daivari and moves him. So Great Khali is going after The Undertaker now. Mm-hmm. Teddy Long then comes out, announces that Bobby Lashley has elevated liver enzymes after his annual checkup in an attempt to make this guy sound like an 8-year-old.
Well, I was surprised that they were honest about that.
He says he cannot compete. And then Lashley comes out. Lashley doesn't think there's anything wrong with him. He came to get his U.S. title back, and fans chant, "Let him fight." And Long says when he is medically cleared, he will have the chance to be United States champion.
So what does this say if Vince is so upset that the Great Khali is being busted for in the Wrestling Observer newsletter for having elevated liver enzymes, yet he clearly freely admits to Bobby Lashley on their TV suffering from the same condition?
Well, he's not a monster. He's an athlete.
He's an athlete,
athletes,
and that's okay.
Elevate their enzymes.
What got to me was that not only did they were they honest about it, but they would poke fun. They would make fun of Bobby Lashley for suffering from elevated liver enzymes.
JBL laughed at it.
Yeah.
He said, "What? I never had elevated liver enzymes, and my liver's in the shape of Jake Roberts."
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Finlay and William Regal come out. Finlay was the U.S. champion here, supposed to fight Lashley. And he says to Teddy, "Give me some skin, player." I thought Finlay and Regal were very funny here. Calls Lashley a coward, wants to be announced the winner by forfeit, and Long announces that there will be a title defense, and Finlay is going to defend the title against William Regal.
Yep.
So if you're a wrestling fan, you're getting a better match here than you would have with Finlay and Lashley, where Finlay would have been carrying Bobby Lashley for 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So the match begins, and Regal starts searching for Finlay's leprechaun friend. Hornswoggle has been around forever.
He has.
6 years.
Yeah, it's been a long time. And he's very young. Well, he was young at the time.
Yep. Now he's getting movie roles.
Yeah.
Stealing microphones away.
And he's a GM.
Yeah. Yeah. Regal turns his back, and Finlay rolls up Regal for a two count, and then Regal slaps him, and they kind of create a bit of a heated situation between the two, and then they lock up in a collar and elbow tie-up, and they go from the ring to the floor and back into the ring with this collar and elbow tie-up. This is a spot I remember Tommy Dreamer and C.W. Anderson did on an ECW pay-per-view. That was the first time I ever saw it. I thought it was the coolest spot that I had never seen before. Regal tosses Finlay to the floor, uses an uppercut for the advantage, and then Hornswoggle grabs Regal's foot and chases him with a shillelagh. And back in the ring, Hornswoggle again grabs Regal from under the ring skirt, grabs his head, bites his fingers, and then Finlay actually works over the fingers by snapping them on the ropes and punching the fingers.
It smells of somebody, the booker or the road agent, saying, "We have this stupid gimmick we have to deal with. How do we make sense of it? How do we work it into an actual match?
Tell a story based on the fingers."
Mm-hmm.
There's an exchange of holds between the two, both working rear chin locks. The two crash heads as Finlay comes off the ropes. A boring chant erupted here, and Cole explains they're chanting boring because they want Bobby Lashley.
Yeah.
And then JBL tries to cover, saying, "No, they're chanting Bobby and not boring."
And I don't necessarily disagree with the crowd here. This style, we're just, the Western world isn't really conditioned to appreciating something like this. And
I was enjoying this match.
Well, I found myself getting kind of bored too, just because.
This was no Czech Congo, Sean Jordan, I think. Come on.
There was no heat between the two here, and
it was two heels here, and the crowd really didn't know how to react.
Right, and you know, just the European style is really not something that this 2006 audience is conditioned to liking.
Regal ends up losing his boot on the floor by Hornswoggle, and then Regal grabs the shillelagh. The referee, Nick Patrick, stops him and has his back turned as Hornswoggle passes Regal's boot over to Finlay, who clocks Regal with it and then uses the ropes to roll up Regal for the win. 13 minutes, 38 seconds, and Cole calls Hornswoggle a little troll and a little bastard as Finlay yanks the title away from the Hornswoggle and then tosses him under the ring, and that's where he lives. Until DX would go into his world and bring him into the real world.
Yes, that's right. I thought the match was a bit too long, and like I said, the audience didn't really seem accustomed to the style, and I thought the finish further dragged this down. But some of the exchanges with the stiff uppercuts and everything were pretty entertaining, but overall, a rather uneventful match, I thought.
Rey Mysterio's in the locker room, and Chavo Guerrero walks in, asks if Rey is ready, says they are like family, and Rey says he feels like a Guerrero. Chavo says that all of the people and Eddie's fans have been proud of Ray and says that one of Eddie's last dreams was to regain the title. So you, Ray, are living Eddie's dream. And I'm here tonight to make sure dreams come true. I love watching heel turns telegraphed just so clearly to the audience.
Yeah. It's pro wrestling, though, you know? Like, it's probably... It needs to be obvious, I almost think.
Sometimes you need to shout at people of what is going to happen so you can anticipate it happening. And this is one of those cases.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it's Chavo Guerrero. And much like 2012 Chavo Guerrero, I wasn't too intrigued by 2006 Chavo Guerrero.
I disagree with you. I thought Chavo did a good job here. He was overplaying the good guy and subtly tease his heel turn. I thought Chavo did a good job.
Gregory Helms against Matt Hardy. Nothing's as pay-per-view like a non-title match. Cruiserweight title not on the line here, as they explain Matt Hardy is no longer within the weight limit.
Is that right?
He was on a grape diet.
Was this the original plan, or was there an injury?
I don't know.
This as well.
It might have been. Hardy hits a leapfrog, and Helms goes underneath, and then Hardy does the hurricane pose to mock Gregory Helms, who had completely ditched the hurricane gimmick here. He was just doing a straight-up Gregory Helms.
Mm-hmm. And, why?
To get away from the comedy, I guess.
So they wouldn't just make him more boring?
I think they were just trying to make him more of a guy that can have some more upward mobility. I mean, the Hurricane was not a main event gimmick, and maybe they had bigger plans for Gregory.
He was way more over as the Hurricane than he ever was as Gregory.
I didn't mind it. I was glad he moved on from the Hurricane. And Hardy clotheslines Helms to the floor in a follow-up plancha. They were frequently bringing up Jeff Hardy in commentary here because they had just started to plug that he was on his way back to the company and would come back in August on Raw, though. Mm. Helms got the heat after a swinging neckbreaker, counters a side effect, gets a two count. JBL says that Helms' enzymes may not be elevated, but his game sure is. Hardy gets crotched on the top, and Helms hit a swinging neckbreaker off the top rope. And Helms then hit applied the underhooks and then was applying knees to a downed opponent here. So it was pride rules in the cruiserweight division. Hardy fights back with shots. It hits a side effect for a two count, then a bulldog. Helms then blocks an O'Connor roll, hits the Shining Wizard for a near fall. Hardy with a moonsault to a standing Helms for a two count, and crowd was getting into the near falls. And then Hardy hitting him with punches in the turnbuckle, gets the snake eyes on the top rope, and then Helms just hooks him with the tights for the win, kind of out of nowhere, at 11:35. Kind of a copy of the match we just saw with Finlay and Regal, and I just thought a bit of a flat finish. It's like they were building to all these near falls and stuff, and then we just get your typical heel 101 finish.
But it wasn't a copy of the previous match. The previous match had Hornswoggle interfere with the
boot. But it was still it was like a roll-up using the ropes.
Okay. I kind of see what you mean. For me, there wasn't much interest in the match to begin with anyway. Despite these two obviously being best friends, it's not like they really played that angle up at all. But overall, technically, it was a good match. This was an instance where I felt JBL was a bit too much here. He kind of took my attention away from the match a little too much. He's very entertaining, and maybe at some points that's part of the problem when you're taking too much focus away.
He made sure to let everyone know how close these two grew up near each other. 40 miles apart from one another.
Yes.
And he also referred to Helms as Greg.
Mm-hmm.
Greg. So there you go. Gregory Helms getting the win. Daivari is trying to stop the Great Khali in the back, and then The Undertaker shows up, throws Daivari down the corridor, and then Big Show shows up attacking The Undertaker. Why is the Big Show there? He's our ECW champion at this point. And attacks The Undertaker, gets separated by security, and then Khali stomps The Undertaker. What is going to happen? Video then airs for the Punjabi prison match. And then we go back to the Big Show celebrating with the Great Khali and Sean Daivari. And Teddy Long stops them from leaving and announces that the Big Show will face The Undertaker in the Punjabi prison match. And the Big Show freaks out.
Yeah.
Quite the decision here. We've promoted a match with the Great Khali. You blindsided The Undertaker, so we're going to remove the advertised match. And Big Show is freaked out by this.
Sure.
He has to face a man he just left laying.
He doesn't want to wrestle in this contraption. Nobody wants to wrestle in the, this.
Well, that's a shoot. No one wanted to wrestle in this contraption. But this was just like, okay, you have to come up with a reason to get Great Khali out of this match, and this is what you came up with.
At what point did they know that Khali would be suspended?
Like more than 24 hours. Like I recall it being like midweek or something. It might have been after SmackDown was taped. I don't know for sure.
Okay. Yeah.
But he was also this monster who I can understand they didn't want to do the beat down and Undertaker lays him out angle. I wouldn't have done that either. You had Khali beat Undertaker clean on the last SmackDown pay-per-view. So you want to keep him strong, but at the same time, I guess there weren't a whole lot of great obvious answers here, but this was kind of weak.
Sure, but considering the circumstances, if it was in fact less than 24, or just slightly more than 24 hours, you know, this was as clever a way as any to write Khali out, I suppose.
Then the Punjabi prison match is being set up, done to the instrumental music from Wrestling with Shadows and the Hyena Call.
Oh, wow, you really... really noticed this.
Did you hear the theme that they had? It was like this crazy jungle music.
I wouldn't know the Hyena theme from Wrestling with Shadows.
Oh, everyone knows the theme from Wrestling with Shadows.
Yeah? How's it go?
I can't do it. But I always, I don't know. This maybe
that
sounded
so... You think we have to pay royalties to...
I might get sued if I hum it. So I'm going to avoid a lawsuit. Michael Cole explaining the rules. There are two structures. You have to escape one structure, then escape a second structure. There's some time limits involved in all this, and doors, along with fucking spikes.
Has there ever been a successful cage match that involves
timers?
One cage inside another cage. Why?
The Kennel from Hell was certainly not a great blueprint.
And yet they... Court Bauer, of course, is going to really get into a lot more about
what was originally envisioned and what Kevin Dunn produced.
Yeah. So two cages with spikes on top. And did you explain that each door, there are four doors on the inside cage and each door can only be opened once for only 60 seconds?
I didn't explain this because Cole didn't either. And I was learning this as I watched the match. I had no idea what was going on when these fucking timers came on and these doors were opening and then doors couldn't open anymore.
So there are four doors on the inside cage, and at any point, a competitor can ask for that door to open, but that door would only open for 60 seconds, and it would close for the rest of the match.
And a moot point on top of it, because, I mean, we've kind of been conditioned with cage matches, but I've always found it, like, here we have the culmination of a big feud. It's a blood feud between two people, and we're going to decide this based on who can climb and escape their opponent. Like, how conclusive is that? I would rather you make him bleed or you make him scream, I quit.
Well, but it's very much like...
Faster than you. I could win a gymnastics competition.
Obviously, if you were competing in a real cage match, that you would try to leave as early as possible. But the idea of a cage match is that you would beat your opponent so that he wouldn't be able to stop you. Beat them down to the point where they can't even get up to stop you.
Yeah, but it never happens like that. It typically is, you know, it's the two of you making a race for the door and climbing. It'd be like you and me, way, getting into a fight right now, and the winner is determined by who can get to Front Street first. That doesn't solve anything. Way is faster than me. That's what we've learned.
It's not always like that. I mean, usually it's somebody narrowly escaping the other person. And the fact
shouldn't the cage be the fact that no one can get in and no one can get out? You're trapped here with me. You've done all your running. You've tried to escape. You've won by countout. Now you're locked in with me. And we're in a prison cell.
Well, they do.
And there's one man that's going to walk out of here.
They do that with the Hell in a Cell. But the part of the drama of a cage match is the climbing over. That's a big part of the drama, and to take that away would take away a big gimmick.
I think the cage match is dead, though.
No.
Oh,
come on.
No one cares about cage matches, Way.
Cage matches.
Hell in a Cell, maybe.
Cage matches.
But a regular cage match, no one cares.
I disagree. Cage matches still remain a great visual spectacle, and I think they're you know, if you protect it well enough, it's still a big deal.
Look at the comments right now on our message board to this show. No one agrees. Steel cages are dead.
To this show?
Yeah, right now.
This is not a steel cage, though.
No, this is the Punjabi prison.
Yeah, highly different.
If you commit a felony in India and go to prison, this is what it looks like. means you have four opportunities to escape, and then you have to just simply climb over. It's not that hard to get out of prison. This is called prison. A device to keep people away from society. Win by escaping.
The best part is that we haven't even gotten to the match yet, but as you'll hear, they put these leather straps at the top of the cage.
Fucking Tarzan ropes.
Well, there's that too, but on the inside cage are these leather straps that Cole explains, just like in a real Punjabi prison, these are leather straps that you can use to torture your victims.
There was torture involved.
What a gimmick. What a great idea.
I give them credit that they came up with this farce of a structure.
And I'll give Kevin Dunn credit. He made this look really good. Maybe that's what his skill is. That's, you know, to make things look good. They lit it well. It looks rather impressive. Although the problem was that on the hard camera, you couldn't see a thing through these cages.
Yeah, it was really tough.
One cage between another cage with made of bamboo.
Big Show's entranceway, he was crying on the way to the ring. Crying.
Yeah.
Grown man crying. Maybe Big Show's got a talent here.
I feel like that was his gimmick. He cried here, and then they made a point of showing him crying after the match.
Well, too. What was hilarious here was that as they started, JBL said that Big Show is now ECW champion. He's finally realized he's a giant. How long has this been his gimmick? He's finally realized he's a giant.
It's always his gimmick. Yeah. It was his gimmick when he turned heel with that Brock Lesnar turn that we talked about.
Undertaker then makes his entrance, showing zero signs of the attack we just witnessed in the back.
Right, yes.
Walks out completely fine.
Yep.
Completely fine. And the line of this entire event was JBL stating, if you love sports entertainment, then you love this.
And that's where I feel I know maybe JBL was like just going too much for I know it's a heel commentator's job to try to sell and put over your product. It's a commentator's job to do that, but I felt like many times in this broadcast he was too over the top to the point where it was nothing but comedic, you know, like he was almost poking fun at the product for overstating just how great this is.
The match began, and it was just downhill from here. They fight onto the top turnbuckle near the leather straps that are connected. Show tries to choke the Undertaker. Taker at one point countered a choke slam into a DDT in midair, and that's when the first door opened, but Taker could not get out. And this is when the countdown clock began. And Michael Cole explained none of this. I'm pretty sure Michael Cole was trying to figure this out on the fly as well. There was some terrible communication here because as a viewer watching this, I was so confused.
The problem with the match like this is that there's no way to explain it that effectively until you actually see guys do it.
There was no need for it. First of all, we didn't need more in this. We needed less. You have to escape two structures. Mm-hmm. There's four doors to get out, and then you got to climb. That's all we needed. We didn't need padlocks and countdown clocks and fucking doors shut. Like, it was just too much. I can't process all this.
I personally don't really... But what's... That's why this gimmick is so really baffling.
The best gimmick matches are the simplest to explain.
Absolutely. But that's why this gimmick is so baffling, because, okay, you escape one cage... And you have to escape another. What's the big deal? Why, like, is the outside cage that much more devastating to climb or something? What's the big deal? You just have to put them in, put another cage outside of that. Does it make it that big of a difference?
This was like watching two children in a jungle gym. Like, that's what this really was. Pardon the pun.
At least with the kennel from hell, you had dogs outside the cage. There's like a moat.
There was actually more. If you looked at it as a shoot.
Yeah.
I would be much more fearful of fucking dogs on the floor.
On a leash, but, you know,
peeing
still.
On me.
Yeah.
Than this Punjabi prison match. Yeah. So anyway, one of the doors gets shut, and then the referees were padlocking the door. So each door, I don't even know what signaled the door opening. Was it someone just snapping their fingers, open the door for me?
They would have to call for it.
And then they had a minute to get out. If the minute expired, they would shut the door and padlock it. So now you were down to three doors to get down.
And that was another problem. There are just so many problems with this match type. The other problem is that knowing that there are four doors and four opportunities, as a wrestling fan, you know that nothing is going to happen for the first two door opens. Nothing is going to happen. And as you could see afterwards, even when all four doors are locked, it doesn't matter. You just climb out.
I remember it was on one of David Lagana's podcasts, I believe. It was either David Lagana or Alex Greenfield that shared this story that around this time on SmackDown, they were pitching something to Undertaker in the writer's meeting. So he has, like, the layout on paper, and Taker's, like, listening to them, and he starts writing. And then he holds up the piece of paper, and it just reads, "Shit." on the script. Great Undertaker story.
That is awesome.
And I thought of that as I'm listening to some agent explain this match to the Undertaker as they're putting it together.
Poor guy, you know? Both of these guys.
You guys are going out for over 20 minutes to pull off the gimmick of all gimmicks here.
Mm-hmm.
And JBL started trying to explain that the Undertaker is not the same as he was before.
That was the side storyline that they were kind of playing
up
here.
Yeah, because Taker had just lost that match to Kali clean. Like, he put Kali over very big. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that was kind of the story they were telling here. But it was done in a way where, because he wasn't facing Kali, it was like Undertaker was coming out the stronger one here, but not against the guy. I don't know. It was just kind of.
I just never got the sense that this was.
It was such a disconnect with
the
Big Show.
I never got the sense that this was an Undertaker match that was different from any other Undertaker match. He seemed as fresh as he always was at this point.
Again, a door opens. They don't make it out. Show chokeslams the Undertaker. Right as the clock hit zero, and Big Show was too slow to get out. Taker started bleeding at one point and hit a big low blow to the Big Show on the top rope. As Taker is a shell of his former self, as JBL says, right as Undertaker then hits a superplex to Big Show off the top rope. Doors open, Taker gets out. Fans then pop, thinking he's won the match as he gets out of the first door. And no, he has just won one of the obstacles in this long course. So Show now has 45 seconds to escape as well.
The idea is that I suppose what makes the inside cage different from the outside cage is that on the outside, there are weapons. Punjabi weapons.
And by Punjabi weapons, Wei means a normal American table covered in a dusty, like...
a cloth.
Cloth. That's Punjabi. It's gotta be dusty.
They're in the desert, aren't they?
Aren't they all... dusty out there?
Oh, shit.
Either that or it was a tribute to Dusty Rhodes' Great American Bash.
Oh, yes.
So anyway, Taker gets out. Then the Big Show gets out of the door. And as the clock is ticking down, Big Show throws the Undertaker back into the ring. And the fourth door shuts. And Undertaker is locked in the ring.
And the match is over. That's the whole idea, right? To lock your opponent inside that first cage.
Wrong. Because there's no ceiling way. So Undertaker just gingerly...
Hold on a second. But there are spikes on top of the cages. What? Then there's no way he can climb out.
There were spikes on the second structure.
There's spikes on both structures.
Were they on both?
If there were, you wouldn't have known, because clearly it was not an obstacle for Undertaker to just scale this thing and get out.
In no time. Just skimmed over the first structure, deeming the doors useless, and then...
Not only did he climb out of the first structure, he climbed from the first structure to the second one, putting
before
him...
Before Big Show could even start climbing the second
putting
structure.
Putting him at an advantage, so,
Anyway, Show gets put through the ancient table... Both men are bleeding here. Great Khali and Daivari then come down to ringside. For what point, I have no clue, because they did nothing. Taker climbs the one structure, jumps onto Big Show, and then he does like this cross body, and him and Big Show both crash through the second structure, equally landing onto the floor at the same time. But for whatever reason, the Undertaker was ruled the winner here.
Mm.
Why? Big Show, technically, his back hit the floor first.
Well, but his back was still touching the cage, and Big Taker happened to roll onto
What a stupid
floor.
Finish. Yeah, like, it was going to be an inconclusive finish, and that's how it was booked. It's not like this was a screw-up. This went according to how they had planned it. 21 minutes and 24 seconds. Colleen Daivari had no input in the finish here, despite coming out to ringside. This match was horrendous.
It was bad.
Terrible match.
It was a bad, bad, bad idea. And I do have to say, I feel like these guys, Taker and Big Show, they were put up against this handicap, and they did their best. They did their best to work it. I'm not going to say that this was a good match, any semblance of a great match, but they did their best, I thought.
They had so much working against them here, and you're right. Between the nonsense of Big Show in this match instead of the Great Khali and what they were
Could you imagine what this match would have been with the Great Khali?
The answer is no.
I've never seen that Batista Great Khali match, but I can't imagine it being any better.
That's what's most amazing is they brought this gimmick back.
Oh, you spent all this money creating this structure. You got to, right?
You got to get your money's worth out of it, and they got two pay-per-views out of it. So that was the Punjabi Prison. And
afterwards, the Big Show cries. Your ECW champion breaks down into tears.
Because he's a giant, and he now realizes he's a giant.
Right. You can't call him out on elevated liver enzymes, but they can cry.
Okay, so that was the Punjabi Prison match. And now, let's hear what the Big Show had to say about the Punjabi Prison match.
I mean, I remember doing the Punjabi Prison match with Undertaker.
Right.
You know, on Saturday, I'm looking forward to watching the match on pay-per-view. Saturday night, I'm flown into the town to do the match
because
the other giant couldn't do it.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was like, okay, and I won't even talk about the payoff I got for that match. But anyway.
Right, well, and let's not talk about it at all for the match that it was as well.
Oh, thanks.
Well, you gotta tell the truth.
Some idiot had the idea of making the bamboo out of steel, so it looks like bamboo, but it's really steel, and it hurt like hell every time you touch it. That was a brilliant idea.
Oh, yeah, there was not too many brilliant ideas in that match, that's for sure.
What did you think about Big Show's comments there?
I thought they were very interesting.
Not a fan of the match. Not a fan.
Oh, wow.
But we continue onwards with the Great American Bash. Then they aired the SummerSlam commercial, which was noteworthy because this was where Batista and Booker had their legitimate fight.
Oh,
they went
right.
into a room, and Booker came out the winner.
What happened? What was the feud? What was the
Apparently, there had been a lot of problems involving Batista on the SmackDown brand for a long time. When he had first been drafted over, he did an interview where he ripped apart SmackDown as the B-team, and people were really upset. The Undertaker kind of voiced his displeasure with Batista doing that. And I think there was always kind of this air of arrogance that people perceived from Batista, whether it was legitimate or not. I don't know. I wasn't there. But it all kind of, I think, just culminated in this where everyone kind of sided with Booker. Booker, from all accounts of people who were there, came out on top of this. And Booker was the one the whole locker room kind of backed and were happy oh. that they had kind of silenced this guy. So that was the most noteworthy news coming out of a photo commercial shoot for WWE.
Yeah.
And then they'd work SummerSlam together. What a brilliant tie-in.
Yeah, yeah.
They should have aired the raw footage. King Booker is with Charmel in the back discussing great men like Alexander the Great, Napoleon, and Julius Caesar, and how he too is going to rule the world, and he will eclipse all of those men. And Charmel just keeps saying, King of the World, and then they kiss.
I thought both were just so entertaining in this gimmick.
Booker was awesome during this time period. I loved him.
It was what a strange idea. But you give it,
you give it to someone who's gonna go the extra mile to get it over, and he did. I felt.
And Booker T is just like he does tremendously with comedy. I find and just an idea as ridiculous as Booker T speaking with an English accent.
It works, like a horrible accent.
It works so well.
And he was someone, I mean, this was a career revival for him. I mean, as Booker T, he was just really stale at the time, and this King gimmick just did wonders for him.
Mm-hmm.
It was great.
Yeah.
Then we went to a four-way bra and panties match.
Oh, the intermission.
Yeah. Crystal Marshall, Jillian Hall, Michelle McCool, and Ashley Massaro. None still with the WWE.
Nope.
I'm going to nitpick here, Way, but What a confusing way to do a bra and panties match where it's a four-way, where you could strip a woman of one of her articles of clothing, but it was the one to strip the final article of clothing would be ruled the winner. This was not elimination. Could we not have just done a singles bra and panties match for the sake of clarity here?
No, you want to see as many people
I found
get
this
stripped.
Confusing.
Nobody is watching this story for match quality.
Well.
And as JBL tells you in this match.
This was Thez Briscoe, as JBL noted.
No, as JBL says in this match, he freaks out at Cole, really, here, because Cole is complaining about athleticism, and or JBL's just like,
they're hot!
Stop calling moves! Nobody cares about their athleticism!
Well, Michelle McCool tries to escape over the barricade, and is stopped by Jillian, and then Crystal takes the shirt off of Ashley, and this is where they explain the rules. Michelle later hit a backbreaker to Ashley, and Jillian with a Thez press to McCool. Are you going to tell me to stop calling the moves?
Yeah, they're hot. Who cares?
Crystal and Michelle get Irish whipped into one another and then get their skirts yanked off, to which McCool has a second skirt on, if you can call it a skirt.
It was a shorter skirt. Yeah.
It was a very short skirt. And Jillian then basically takes Crystal's face and motorboats her into her tits. And then Ashley takes Crystal's top off for the win. At 5 minutes and 14 seconds, longer than any bra and panties match needs to be. And then Ashley pulls Jillian back into the ring. They pants one another. Crowd was kind of dead for this. And then Hall does the same. And they say, look at us. Look at us. We're almost naked.
Yeah. They willingly stripped.
That was our bra and panties match.
I've said it in the past. I don't really have a problem with having one of these on the show. They're just a break for...
They're good. They're good to break things up.
Yeah.
Theme song for the show, Way, was Blackstone Cherry's performance of Lonely Train. Lonely Train. Because so many guys have been suspended that it was a lonely train to Indianapolis.
And the Blackstone Cherry, where does that fit in?
Blackstone Cherry? I don't know. It's a horrible name for a band.
Pretty bad.
Then we went to just what a visual here.
Yeah.
2006 The Miz interviewing 2006 Mr. Kennedy.
Hi, Miz Fitz.
I hated this guy so much in 2006. I just wanted him to go away.
This dude was such a goof. I don't know if they're trying to portray him as such on purpose. Like, they think Mark Lloyd. This was Miz as Mark Lloyd.
Only Mark Lloyd never won the WWE title.
Yeah.
If you had told me one of these men are going to win the WWE title and one will not,
and
you told me it was The Miz, I would just say, no, you're wrong. There is nothing, nothing in the world The Miz can do to become a world champion over Kennedy.
And to headline WrestleMania. No
less. Wow.
Yeah.
How is it conceivable, Way, in 2006 that The Miz became the star of these two?
It's really an amazing, it's an incredible transformation.
What does that tell you about Kennedy? Like, what happened to this guy?
I don't think he
Dude, Kennedy was great here.
Yeah, he was good, but he was good by Kennedy standards today. Yeah, he was good. But you can't compare him to The Miz and say that there's something wrong with Kennedy. I think it's just, you can look at anybody.
Absolutely, you can. Kennedy, listen.
There is something wrong with Kennedy.
If he retired tomorrow, the story on Kennedy was a guy that had all the potential and fizzled.
I personally.
He has never reached what the potential has been.
Perhaps, but
this guy was pushed to the moon here.
But I see that more as The Miz just making an incredible transformation versus Kennedy. Certainly, Kennedy has
made a transformation too.
Yeah, he did,
and had the worst luck and timing in the world. Wellness suspensions, misdiagnosis, where he had to lose the Money in the Bank briefcase, being very vocal about drug use, and then being caught for drug use. A lot of misfires, I think, in this guy's career, unfortunately. And someone who you watch this show felt like a can't-miss future main eventer. He says he's going to defeat Batista tonight and do what Mark Henry couldn't. And that leads us to Batista in his first pay-per-view match since December of the last year when he tore his triceps, taking on Mr. Kennedy. And this was supposed to be Batista and Mark Henry, but Henry had blown out his knee and out of action for 8 to 10 months.
Yeah, that's a long time.
This guy, another one who's had some horrible luck in his career. Yeah. And Kennedy does his entrance, walks with this weird limp to the ring. He's like limping. He's like awkward, like he's going to fall over. Kennedy is attacked at the bell. Batista is actually booed here by the crowd.
I was very confused here. This was Batista.
Because Kennedy was like the Ziggler of the time.
Right, I see.
He was the guy everyone was hot for, and Batista was this guy being somewhat the promotion's choice as babyface.
Well, then that made the finish all the more
confusing
to me.
Yes.
I'll get to.
It's very confusing. Didn't go long here. Kennedy got busted open above his forehead early on when he was tossed into the steps. And he teases leaving, but runs back, gets speared by Batista. Kennedy was really aggressive here, was fighting back, hit the face wash to Batista in the corner, and then attacks the left arm of Batista and goes after his tricep. Batista repeatedly sends Kennedy shoulder first into the post, and then Batista starts choking him with his boot and does not break the five count and is disqualified at 8 minutes and 33 seconds. A puzzling finish, to say the least. This was Batista's first pay-per-view back. You have already had to make so many changes on this card to what fans had been advertised to see.
Mm-hmm.
And Batista was going to be facing the world champion at the next pay-per-view. Like, I understand, Kennedy, maybe you didn't want to beat him. Then don't put him in this match. This was a horrible finish.
Yeah.
This was just like a, man, I took a chance on this pay-per-view with all these changes, all these problems, a shit match just before this, and you're going to give me a screw job here at the end in 8 minutes.
Yeah, perhaps they're thinking that, you know, these fans are getting Batista's first pay-per-view match. Maybe that means something.
Awesome. But,
for me watching this as a standalone show 6 years later, it was a total waste of my time. A terrible finish to a
This was a TV match.
Pretty nothing match. Afterwards, Cole says, Batista makes a statement in his return to pay-per-view.
Yeah, the statement was, I'm not ordering the next time he's on pay-per-view. Yeah. After the match, tried to get his heat here. We gave 3 spinebusters and a Batista bomb, and Kennedy was left laying in the ring. I thought Kennedy looked good in this match. Real, like, aggressive. The blood added to this a bit. And watching this, I felt that Kennedy, like, really felt like he was poised for something. But
I was never a fan, personally.
No. I enjoyed him during this time period. Promo airs for Hogan versus Orton at the following month's SummerSlam, which we have reviewed, which you can listen in our Review Away archive. And we had another SmackDown member on that podcast with Alex Greenfield, who was the head writer of SmackDown at the time, joining us. So we decided to break it up this time with Court Bauer. Different perspective here for a Great American Bash, so you can get both sides there. Then we go to the main event after a video airs for Booker and Mysterio. And do you want to describe Booker's entrance?
Booker came out in, what do you call that?
It was like a stage attached to like a truck.
Some type
of driving him out.
Some type of carriage with this throne. It looked very extravagant. But Booker came out, of course, with Queen Charmel. And that was that.
And then we had Ray come out to Booyaka. By POD, payable on death.
Yep.
Big, yeah.
You're a fan?
I bought their CD in 2002.
Was there a song on it?
They had the song Alive and Satellite and Youth of the Nation.
I thought they were a good band.
I didn't mind them.
I thought they were good.
They had like a kind of a Linkin Park kind of vibe to them.
Except Christian.
Yeah, Christian rock. That was always a turnoff. I was never a fan of the term Christian rock. It just felt like they were like trying to do like metal about like, you know, communion at mass or something. I don't know.
There's nothing wrong with that. People sing about what they're passionate about, and I thought the music was good.
Passionate about God.
Yeah.
Passion on... what's a D we can use?
P-O-G.
P-O-G. Pog. Payable on God. We go to the main event. Booker takes off.
Before we go, what was the genesis of this Booker T. King Booker gimmick?
He won the King of the Ring. They did it on television, and then I think the finals were at Judgment Day with Bobby Lashley. Booker won, and with good reason, because he could do a lot more with the gimmick than King Bobby could.
Oh my God, thank goodness. Here's a guy who really ran with this King gimmick.
Benefited from
and if there's an argument for the King of the Ring coming back, it's an example like this.
Now, some people thought at the time that this was too much comedy for the main event.
Yes.
I I really enjoyed Booker, and I didn't have a problem with this.
I'm trying to justify that in my own head, too, because I'm one of those people that thinks there's often, you know, the comedy has no place in a main event angle, but I'm trying to think why this feels different to me. Maybe it's just because it's so entertaining.
And the comedy ended when the match began.
Yes.
I think that also helped.
He still, like, managed to get legitimate heat, as you could see at the end of this match, for cheating to beat Rey Mysterio, and I felt like it was just so appropriate that this king, would have the title. It just seemed right to me.
The SmackDown Kingdom.
Yes.
So Booker gets into Rey's face saying that Eddie can't help him. Then he takes off his royal ring and hands it to Charmel, and JBL explains that it was given to him by Paul Bosch, the legendary Houston promoter.
JBL just, like, throughout this entire entrance...
Just makes up shit.
I don't often like to, you know, think it's worthwhile to watch entrances or when we watch these old shows, but, like, watching this, like, part of the draw for this whole gimmick is to just see JBL bullshit his way through the entire entrance. It is so entertaining. We are so blessed to be visited by royalty. Charmel, she is the second coming of Shiva.
He has such a delivery about himself that is so convincing, and you have to have a really great bullshit filter. And it was like when we were at the Hall of Fame,
yeah,
and he's doing this speech about, you know, I'm here to introduce Ron Simmons, and him and I remember back in 1999... him and I on Raw, we did a 9.5 quarter, and I challenge any of you guys to do a 9.5 quarter. Right. Like, bullshit coming from this man's mouth, but done in such a way.
He's a Chael Sonnen.
Yeah, yes, he's got the Chael Sonnen delivery, where it's enough that people don't challenge him. And it was, he was great.
Although here it was clearly comedic, like clearly over the top for fun, but it was just so entertaining to listen to.
JBL and Michael Cole had gotten this big argument about socialism.
At some point, how it began was Cole and JBL are arguing about underdogs, and how JBL saying that this country was built on people like J.B. Rockefeller. And then Cole was like, what are you talking about? This country, without people like Rey Mysterio, we would have no highways in this country. Just something ridiculous. But it was very funny. And then JBL was like, Cole, you're a socialist. You must subscribe to the New York Times. Very funny.
Incredible stuff. So, into the actual match, and Mysterio hits a tilt-a-whirl leg scissors and then got the momentum, but Booker would cut him off with, like, anytime Mysterio got anything going, Booker would just, like, cut him off with, like, a thumb to the eye or something. We saw a seated senton to the floor by Mysterio, and then went for a moonsault off the top, lands on his feet, and Booker with a super kick that drops Rey. Booker this got great heat. He hit the three amigos to Rey, and Cole just yells, sacrilege! And then continues on. He does, like, the Eddie, like, shuffle. And then Rey gets out of the way for the scissors kick, and Rey fights back with a bunch of kicks, a drop toe hold, but then misses the 619 and kicks Booker in the head, goes for the 619 again, but this time Charmel trips Rey, and she gets tossed to the back, which is always an easy pop when the manager gets thrown to the back. Rey then goes for a Hurricane Rana off of a press slam, hits a DDT. There's a kick out by Booker, and then Rey gets tossed off of Booker, takes out referee Nick Patrick after a head scissors attempt. Rey then goes for a springboard seated senton, hits the 619 and a frog splash, but the referee is still out. Booker hits a low blow, and then the royal bookend.
The royal bookend.
It's a step up from the regular bookend.
Okay.
And then Booker gets a chair, misses Rey, and then takes a drop kick from Rey with the chair hitting him in the head. And then Chavo comes down to ringside, picks up the chair, and did Vince Russo proud as he went to go hit Booker. Alternated the hip movement and crashed the chair right into Rey's skull. A John Pollock disgusted head chair shot. And Booker covers him.
For such a cliched spot, I actually thought they made it look pretty decent here.
Yes, this wasn't the obvious just going for Booker and then turning 90 degrees.
Yeah.
It was like one fluid movement.
Yes.
But, this chair shot. I feel like a broken record, but nonetheless. Patrick comes back in, counts three, 16 minutes and 36 seconds, and the horrendous title reign of Rey Mysterio came to an end, where this guy got zero help booking-wise, just did so many jobs during this point in time.
Yet,
but someone who just such a natural, great underdog champion that pulled out these wins. I thought they cut the title reign too short, but with Booker, they certainly had a lot of ideas behind him moving forward.
Yeah, and for how poorly they did book Mysterio, the crowd here...
Guys stayed over the whole time.
Crowd here was livid when he lost the title. I thought this was a good match. I enjoy both characters. And then at the end, you get Booker celebrating and the look on this guy's face as he's like about to cry. It's very funny.
And then Charmel ends the pay-per-view by just over and over and over yelling, "All hail King Booker."
It's so bizarre. Like something that you just really can't write. Like, I don't think a writer can come up with this on a piece of paper. It's just like, it feels very organic the way the whole gimmick came together. And it was great. I really liked the gimmick.
All right. At this point in time...
What do you rate this show?
I give this show... Oh, geez. I'm going to go low and say a 3.5 out of 10. I didn't really feel there were any real standout matches. The prison match was just god-awful. Batista and Kennedy had a really bad finish. I can't give this a thumbs up by any stretch.
Oh, me neither, no. Yeah. I found the show entertaining for the wrong reasons. Like the Punjabi prison match, and I really enjoyed the main event, but the rest was kind of didn't really stand out. I'd say this was an average for me. I give it a 5 out of 10.
All right, we're gonna get into your feedback, but first of all, we're gonna go back in time right now. Actually, where should we go right now? We have a few different options we can go in. Let's first hear from Court Bauer, because me and Wei chatted with Court about this entire show, the Punjabi prison match, and what was originally the idea which Bauer had come up with. So here we go. Court Bauer from MLW Radio and a former writer here on the SmackDown crew during this time period of the Great American Bash 2006. All right, we have just wrapped up our review of the 2006 Great American Bash, an event that I think lives on because of one in particular gimmick, and to give us further insight into what was going on in this time period, a member of the SmackDown writing staff at that time, and you can see all of his work doing the MLW Radio podcast up right now with Conan and Mr. St. Laurent, and a frequent guest here on The Law, Court Bauer is with us. And Court, how are things going today?
Hey, man, what's going on, guys?
Well, what is up is the Great American Bash 2006. I think an event that I think was categorized as the elevated liver enzymes pay-per-view for the SmackDown brand. So for listeners that are maybe new to our show and haven't heard in the past, why don't you just tell us kind of your involvement on the SmackDown side at this particular point and kind of when you came on to the writing staff leading up to this show, because you were about a year in, I believe.
Right, yep. This was my second not so great American Bash, and it seemed like ever since WWE started doing the Bash pay-per-view, it almost was snake bitten, and there was actually kind of a running joke within the creative department that it was a cursed show and there would never be a successful one, and I can't remember if there really ever being a great one under my watch there. But, you know, it was part of the SmackDown team, and that was, at the time, a SmackDown-specific show, where at this point in time, the brands were very separate.
Yes.
You didn't have talent crossing over. Whoever was on SmackDown headlined the Great American Bash pay-per-view from the opening match to the closing match. You had no guys represented from Raw, which means the creative end, you had only SmackDown's involvement in writing the show and booking it. Raw had nothing to do with it, which meant great things for us in terms of being able not to deal with the politics of it. But then when you instate a or start a drug testing policy and decide to now it's a good time to check on the well-being of our talent, and you check the oil and everything, you realize how catastrophically bad some of these guys are, you know, whether they have knee injuries, whether they have testosterone issues or whatever it is, you couldn't. I mean, I was on the phone with Vince along with other guys, and he got the med report back, all the meds back for basically the SmackDown roster, and he starts reading off some of them, which is really private, confidential information, and we're just listening to this, and like, it really sounded like you couldn't get a worse sounding roster in terms of injuries, and you know you don't realize how these guys work through pain and how they are able to go on the road 200, 250 dates a year, and you know, maybe a handful of those times really give you matches that last and hold up 10 years later. And these guys, I mean, it's just such a testament to what they do, but also really concerning and disturbing because these guys are busting their ass, but it's really taking their toll on their body, or they've abused steroids or growth hormone, and it, you know, affects their liver, it affects other things. And then, as we learned, allegedly, some of those tests were actually bad tests that had to be thrown out. So, long story short, this was a turbulent time. You didn't know who was going to be suspended or taking a siesta or whatever for WWE and SmackDown going into the show. But I was one of the guys on the SmackDown team. We had people dedicated to writing, you know, the scripts, writing the promos for talent. And I never really was too interested in that because I was always uncomfortable handing most of these guys dialogue to read. And if I did, I always just gave him bullet points and kind of would work on it and then work on it with Vince, who really never had a problem with that process. But Stephanie seemed to really like a real kind of like you would see in a screenplay, you know, just really a detailed script that actually, you know, explains, you know, move for move if he's moving through a room backstage or eye contact. I mean, it's very detailed at points, and other times it's not. My thing on SmackDown was kind of to do the long-term planning, and looking at the young talent either in developmental or on the mid card or lower card level that wasn't being utilized, and try to find ways to get them back in the mix, or in some cases, which I really loved, is to look at the international scene, or the indies, and kind of cherry pick people and try to get them signed and then of course get them on SmackDown as soon as possible. So I was long-term planning probably, I don't know, I want to say May of 2006, maybe even earlier. It might have been around WrestleMania 2006 that I first thought, you know, it'd really be cool to do something different. We had the Hell in a Cell match. We had a steel cage match. You had all types of different concepts introduced to WWE over the years, the Inferno match and all types of stuff, you know, dogs attached to Hell in a Cell and you know, all that stuff with Al Snow and his WrestleMania match. Or was it Al Snow? Who was in that one? Was it Al Snow and
It was Undertaker and Boss Man.
Undertaker
and Boss Man,
that's right, that's right.
And Snow and Boss Man had the infamous the Kennel from Hell.
That's it. That's what I'm getting them all. So, like, point being, there's been a, you know, the entire WWE universe is littered with terrible matches. But I thought it'd be kind of interesting to introduce a death match with the exploding ring, and try to do it in an arena where you could deal with the explosions and the pyro and all this stuff. And I was thinking WrestleMania 2007, knowing that we were going to be in Detroit, it would be big enough to handle it. And of course, when you think that long term in wrestling, it always gets sped up. And before we knew it, we were talking about doing it at the Great American Bash. So by, you know, late spring, Vince signs off. We're gonna do the first ever exploding death match in WWE history, and we'll do it because we were looking at ways to promote the Bash, because it's always a hard sell in the middle of the summer to do a Great American Bash, to do a pay-per-view in July. It's very difficult. People are away. People are at camp. There's a lot of movies out. It's just, you know, it's hard to get your crew together and watch a pay-per-view you know, at this point in time in wrestling. So he signs off in the match. I show him literally the video of Terry Funk doing it with Cactus Jack and a few others from FMW. And he loves the spectacle. He loves how the countdown and then the ring explodes and everything and the chaos and all the plunder. And, you know, Dusty Rhodes, when I'm pitching this to Vince and showing him on video on the screen, Dusty's starting to do live commentary, giving his own commentary of the FMW matches. It was just – it was terrific. So we get this whole thing set up. It's signed off on. We have a budget for it and everything. And at this point, you hand the idea off to production/TV, and they take care of these logistics. And that's Kevin Dunn's department. He's the executive – Vince is the real executive producer, but Kevin Dunn is technically the executive producer of WWE programming. And so he's not only responsible for – the cameras and the production, it's, you know, beaming it to the satellites, but he also does the production elements, whether it's, you know, if the ring needs to be different in terms of the canvas color or the ring post should be green for Money in the Bank. Under his department, they take care of that. And so he was going to be taking the concept of the exploding death match and taking care of the logistics, and I said, you know, I can help. I can get you in touch with people over and from Japan that were involved with this. They can, you know, even Terry Funk can explain and fully could explain what goes into this and try to make this as safe as possible, but also succeed so it's not a bust. And, I never heard anything from them. And, sitting there with Alex Greenfield, Dusty, David Lagana, and we're just, you know, we're leaving messages, not getting anything back from Kevin Dunn or his department. And we bring this up to Stephanie, and, you know, she says, well, you know, let me check. And a few weeks pass, and we finally get the mock-up artwork for the Exploding Death Match. And instead of it being anything like what we had laid out or what I had pitched, it is what would become known as the Punjabi prison match. It was bamboo. It looked like bamboo furniture gone awry and made into a prison. And we're just looking at this and we're baffled. And I mean, like, my heart sunk because I was so – this to me was going to be a big thing. I was really excited as a fan. And in terms of my career, I thought I was going to introduce something to WWE that could be really cool. At least if it – and if it was bad, it would be memorably bad. But what I saw, I just said, well, this isn't anything. This had – none of my DNA on it. It didn't have anything I'd pitched. There was nothing exploding. It was just bamboo. And there was even at one point like leaves and stuff. I mean, it was just – it looked like a playground or something. And I asked Steph. I said, well, okay, is it okay if I give just some feedback? And they go, well, Kevin's already built it. So there's nothing to be said. I mean, they've already taken the money. They've already built it. And, by this point, we're about three or four weeks out from the show. And so, well, we just had to pretty much go with what we had. And so you had this match and Undertaker learns about the bamboo stick and everything and trying to understand how to use it. And, you know, the bamboo doesn't have the give. It can be kind of hard to play with. So, you know, he's trying to figure out how he's going to work with a guy that's very limited. In a match where you're supposed to climb out now instead of it exploding, which would have been, you know, we were going to have a lot of hardcore gimmicks. So, you know, dancing originally was supposed to be Great Khali and Undertaker. And so, you know, Khali's very limited and, you know, he's a freak show and giant. So, you don't expect him to do the things that a Shawn Michaels would do or Kurt Angle would do or, you know, a million other guys. So that's why we're going to have this kind of match, because you're going to have an explosion. We were going to have, you know, tables, chairs, whatever we were going to put in it to kind of distract from what you can't do with Khali. But when in this case, you're really stuck in a thing that you have to climb over, and even the wood was kind of, shifty. Everyone was just kind of scratching their head, and Vince was sold on it by Kevin Dunn, so our hands were tied. And so there goes the Exploding Death Match, which is yet to happen in WWE. I'm sure one day it will. But then we find out that Khali's now suspended. And I don't remember the particular reason for his suspension, but he was out and he was replaced by Big Show. So Big Show is now facing Undertaker in a prison, a Punjabi prison match, which made no sense at all. And as you can tell, if you ever watched that footage, and I don't know why you would watch the Great American Bash 2006, but if you did, the finishes of Undertaker very kind of carefully launching himself over, I think, the top ropes onto Big Show, who kind of just clumsily falls through a rigged door, and it just kind of collapses behind him, and they kind of softly fall backwards like they were in slow motion on a child's bed, and this kind of gently Undertaker rolls off, and the match is over. And I just couldn't believe what this had gone from and then what it had turned into. And, you know, only in wrestling, you know, I said that so many times during my years from MLW to WWE. I said, you shake your head sometimes because there's just no other way to cope with it or rationalize it. Just only in wrestling.
Who would you say was responsible for, not, you know, I suppose you could point to Kevin Dunn to build the contraption, but the actual rules surrounding the timing of opening the, each door and a cage within a cage, who would you say was, were responsible for forming the rules of this match?
You know, I think Vince was really involved. He liked the idea of kind of making, you know, having these countdowns in a different way. And so, again, it was kind of like it mutated from a countdown to this hell breaking loose in a WWE ring with exploding death match to a countdown, and then you leave a cage. And it was like a warped version of that what was that, the Three Cages of Doom thing that they did with Macho Man and Hogan back in WCW, which
– oh, yeah.
Which, again, if you look at it, ironically, pretty much was the same kind of thing. They both – you didn't know what the finish was. Everyone looked confused. It was terrible, and it was just a disaster. I mean, these kind of matches, there's a reason why you don't see them back being used every yeah. again. So.
And at this time, Cord as well. I mean, Great Khali is kind of to the fan of the last few years, Great Khali very much presented as a comedic performer. But at this time, Khali came in with a lot of steam at the prior month's pay-per-view. It was Judgment Day, beating Undertaker clean. Like, there was clearly a big momentum here behind the Great Khali character.
Yeah, well, he was one of my projects. Like I said, I like to bring in unique talent. I realized SmackDown was also kind of the place where you introduce talent and then they take off, they go to Raw, which kind of that was all kind of set in motion when John Cena, you know, ascended in through SmackDown and then was switched over to Raw when he became champion at WrestleMania 21. So Great Khali was a guy that we were looking at, and I wanted a guy like that because I really believe that you can't just have 30 guys that look like they're off an assembly line from a clone factory. I think you do need a big fat guy. You do need a muscle guy. You need a giant. You need guys that have some sort of unique traits about them. And that variety leads to, you know, when you're switching the channel, you see a guy that looks like King Kong Bundy, or you see a guy that looks like Earthquake, or you see a guy that looks like George Animal Steel. It gives you variety, or you see the Legion of Doom. And I thought Khali had a unique look, and I felt that you would have a short run with him, but he could be a monster that you ultimately feed to Undertaker and serves a purpose. And there's still to this day is an issue there. It's like, well, if they can't work like, you know, Triple H or Shawn or this guy, then, you know, really, what are we wasting our time on? And to me, it's like, you can't have everyone work. It would be great if everyone did, but the reality is, that's kind of what makes Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart, and Randy Orton, is that, you know, those guys do what they do, but you need other guys to do something different. And I believe firmly in variety in how you present a product, both mechanically and in terms of aesthetics. So Khali, I felt would be a great monster to do. I loved feeding monsters to the top baby faces. I really love that old school thing that Gary Hart, my mentor, had instilled in me, in that he always had monsters, whether it was Bruiser Brody or Great Muta, you know, all shapes and sizes, but they all were unique and they were very different because, you know, whether it was the Von Erichs or Ric Flair or Sting, they were not fighting necessarily the monster, but the cause behind the monster. And that, when you're fighting a cause or a belief, you can dispose of these heels and keep fighting that cause that's behind them, whether it's Bobby Heenan and the Heenan family or Paul Heyman and the Dangerous Alliance. And you can feed all those guys and then keep feeding guys, and you can keep that – you can sustain that program for a year or 2 years sometimes. And that's what I really wanted to accomplish with Khali. And originally, he was going to be introduced by the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase. And we were going to really go back to the Undertaker's origins in WWE and how Ted DiBiase had brought him in. And we were going to tell this very elaborate story and how he was going to bring in all these guys to take out the Undertaker for, you know, the issues involving why Undertaker ultimately would go on a different direction with his career and all this stuff. So that was one way we were going to do it. And also we were going to introduce Khali with a few other people, including Gary Hart. But Gary Hart passed on that idea. So I really believe big in a variety of talent. And this was Khali's kind of supposed to be a shining moment. His June of 06 was pretty big too. But, you know, these things happen and you kind of roll with the punches. You try to put together the best card you can. And if you look back on paper, you had a pretty decent show. You had, you know, Booker T defending the title. I think he was defending the title. No, Rey Mysterio was defending the title against King Booker, and he lost. You had Mr. Kennedy, Mr. Anderson, TNA now, against Batista. And we really felt at the time that Ken Anderson was a guy that just had unlimited potential. And, you know, as you learn, as you go through wrestling, as a matchmaker, as a promoter, as a member of the process, you know, some guys, you get it right. And some guys you don't, and some guys stop maturing and developing as a talent for whatever reasons or circumstances, and it doesn't take off, or the fans just something happens and it just doesn't click. But we really thought at the time that Mr. Kennedy was going to be something very special and be a big part of the company for several years. I mean, to the point where, you know, where it's like, well, we could take him and maybe position him against The Undertaker and do the whole streak thing and see how that plays out. So it was an interesting card. You know, Gregory Helms was on it with face off against Matt Hardy. You had Fit Finlay against Regal, which to me was one of my favorite matches. And seeing those guys, whenever they wrestle, I don't care if it was for 2 minutes or 7 minutes, 20 minutes, I love just watching those two guys wail on each other with their European uppercuts and the double arm suplexes and just the real snug British style that those two just love to do. And then we also had like Paul London and Brian Kendrick against Noble and Kid Cash, which was a fun opener. So it was a really nice, balanced show, I thought, except for the train wreck in the middle, which was Taker versus Big Show in a Punjabi prison match. But, you know, it was also fascinating doing that show, and you're working on it with the architect for the original Great American Bash concept, Dusty Rhodes, who, you know, as we'd sit there dying, trying to figure out ways to make the show work, would also always give me some crazy story about what happened in like 85 or 86 with, you know, down when he was booking it in, for the Crockett's. And so it was great getting that, those kind of little like pop-up Dusty videos where he just kind of just share these great stories, from being on the road. And back in the day in the 80s, Great American Bash was like a month and a half long tour where they would take, you know, the Jim Crockett promotion, which would become WCW, and you'd go all from, you know, they just do house shows like almost every night, and they'd call it the Great American Bash Tour, and they'd do a War Games match in, I think, every town or something, and Flair would defend the title, and it would just be like an ongoing house show series, like a real tour for weeks on end during the summer, and then it morphed slowly into a pay-per-view when WCW stopped doing house shows. But, you know, it had a very rich history, a very positive history up until probably the WWE embraced the concept and the pay-per-view. But it was back in the day. If you watch some of those tapes, they're great. They really are. They're Southern fried and they're really good.
What was the reaction like in the back following the initial Punjabi prison match? And was there any talk of just doing away with the concept at that time, or did people want to continue?
I think everyone was just happy it was over and that no one got hurt. people were falling left and right because of elevated enzymes and all types of weird shit that you really didn't know what was going to happen next. You just wanted these guys to come out of this match, not hurt, and you didn't want it to be a complete train wreck. Well, we accomplished one of the two, so we thought, oh, that's not that bad. We can live with that.
How about, you know, the wellness policy had a lot to in terms of the adjustment of this card. So many people, they kind of point to the Chris Benoit tragedy as kind of a real turning point in policing themselves. But here we were a year prior to that, and this pay-per-view was pretty much completely reshuffled based on wellness issues. I mean, did you find it to be – it was a pretty ironclad policy at this time, or was it something that it was – heavily enforced on the mid-card? I mean, as someone on the writing team, how much were you involved with, you know, the outcome of that stuff, and how much you guys were kind of kept in the loop in terms of that?
We had no input. We were never asked to give input. It was pretty much some emails would be shot our way and we'd be told this guy would be unavailable for 30 days. We wouldn't necessarily be told why or what happened, but we, you know, he could be on vacation. We wouldn't know. And then you'd hear, wrestling being what it is, you know, people talk and you hear what happened. Or you just talk to the guy and he tells you, he failed the test. Or, you know, Dave Meltzer would tell me. So that's kind of what would happen. And I really felt that the time that, you know, this was long overdue. You know, I had one of my dear friends, Gary Albright, who was an All Japan star and a shooter back in the 90s. You know, he died in the ring in January 2000. And that was catastrophic for me. He was a great man, and you know, I was just in the business for a year or two at that point. You know, I was like 20 years old, and he literally was going to, after that match, come up to New York. He was in Allentown, Pennsylvania. He was going to come up to New York and stay with me at my parents' house, which would have been interesting to have a wrestler hanging out for a few days. But I didn't even, wow. I didn't even think about it. I was like, it's Gary, you know, what the hell? You know, I didn't even, that didn't even factor in, I guess, at the time to me. But he was literally going to come after that show and come up to see me. And it was just devastating. So I always felt having that hit home very young to me, very hard too, that this was something I really wanted. I always, when I was a promoter in MLW, and if I was promoter in 2012, I would say, you got to take it out of the promoter and ownership's hands. This should be regulated. You should have a commission that does the meds. And it's not going to be perfect because obviously if you look at the independents, how many often does a guy go through, you know, New York or, you know, Michigan if it's once a year or something. But I think it'd be a little bit more honest, a little, you know, you wouldn't question the integrity as much. I mean, you're always going to have issues if you look at UFC in Vegas and some of the stuff that's gone on out in Nevada recently. But I just felt that you can't give it to the wrestling promoters and leave it up to them because outside WWE, they really can't afford it. Even TNA can't really afford it. I guess they could. They can afford all these other guys. But I think it would just be better if it was regulated. And if I was promoting today, I would say New York, you know, regulate. Please, Florida, regulate. You know, Pennsylvania, please, make it easy. I don't care if it's a fee. You know, we're taxed on the gate. Let's find a way to make it work. So when this all started happening in WWE, I felt kind of like when you do construction on your house and it's an old house, and once you open up those walls or someone's taking a look at an old car and you're looking out, you open the hood, you really don't know what the damage is until you open up the hood or open up the house and really look what's on the inside. And once WWE peeled it back and you got to see what was going on with some of the guys and their medical issues, you know, it was pretty catastrophic in terms of planning and logistics. But Vince McMahon was very committed to righting the issue. And if you look at, you know, over the next few years, yes, there were certainly wrestling deaths, you know, guys dying prematurely. But if you look at this card, and this is a real positive thing in that, you know, King Booker still alive, Rey Mysterio still alive, Kennedy still alive, Batista still alive, Undertaker still with us, Big Show, Gregory Helms, Matt Hardy, Finlay, Regal, London, Kendrick, Noble, Kid Cash, all the men on this pay-per-view are still alive. But if you go back 3 years maybe, I bet you'll find half those guys that were on a pay-per-view maybe alive. I mean, so I think it's a testament to the wellness policy, and of course you can always, you know, do a little bit of house cleaning and tighten it up, and there always is going to be a question about why certain guys on top haven't had a problem passing. But, you know, I gotta say, if you look at the results and look at everyone's been at WWE in the last, since the, you know, since pretty much 2005, you're gonna see that there's a big difference. And, you know, another one of my friends that passed away was Umaga, and he was a dear friend of mine, and a guy that was so talented and just had just endless potential. And one of the reasons why he was no longer affiliated with WWE at the time was because of issues he had with drugs. There's only so much you can do. And if these people are unable to comply because of the addiction or because of whatever inability to commit to rehab, then what can you do? But you gotta be pretty much fair but firm on this. They certainly were with Umaga, who was a WrestleMania headliner, and obviously they needed a guy like that in the company. There is a lot of positive that came out. So I look back, and it was a very chaotic time, a very stressful time, and I don't think the show was artistically or creatively top notch, but you know, you tried to do your best to turn chicken shit into chicken salad, and I think we may not have succeeded, but we got as close as you probably could under the circumstances.
What was it like in terms of just, the internal kind of competition between Raw and SmackDown? Was it something that it was more kind of a creation on the outside, or what was there, you know, legitimate in terms of when it came to going after talent and what brand would get which specific talent? Did that exist in the creative level?
It was ruthless. It was ruthless. It was a shark tank, man. If a outside talent or developmental guy or a guy that used to be with the company came back and looked great in a dark match, oh man, the fighting would start right from the jump. And you'd have guys, you know, saying, oh, you know, pitching Vince on how they could introduce him next week and stuff. And the problem with that process is, okay, you get him on your roster and you introduce him the following week, but you really don't have a game plan or strategy. So you introduce him, and then what? And they kind of just flounder. And that's what happened with guys, you know, Trevor Murdoch, who I really thought could have had a huge run at WWE. And Lance Cade. I thought also could have had a really good run, but I really believed that Trevor Murdoch was the money in that group because he could cut a great promo. He looked different. He bumped differently. Everything about him was different. He was unique, but that was one of those things where we wanted to put him on SmackDown, but we wanted to do vignettes and do all this stuff. But Brian Giewertz and company, Michael Hayes at the time was on Raw, and Vince acquiesced and let them have him and along with his tag partner, and you know they had a big impactful debut, but then they were quickly forgotten. So you know you need to set the table and set the stage so you can have a great performance. And when you have this kind of issue and you have these rivalries and the McMahon family kind of fans the flames and wants that competitive spirit like they do with their top talent a lot of the time, you know, that's great with top talent because I think it brings out the competitiveness and the creativity and the athleticism, so they're always trying to deliver the best they can. In creative, it's different because you are all kind of the architects of stories that kind of, you know, kind of connect and are interconnected and you're, you know, it'd be like, you know, you have three writers for The Dark Knight Rises, but they all have a vested interest in their own guy. And at the end of the movie, you're just scratching your head and saying, instead of static, yes, that was the greatest climax in all of superhero movies. And that's what that should be your goal, is to try to build the greatest story you can and get as many people over as you can and give the customer the best quality you can. And I don't think that's really an objective sometimes because of the competitive spirit. And now it's not the same as it was then because it's pretty much all hands on deck. You know, the meetings, both teams are involved. You know, when it comes down to accountability, you know, lead writers, if they have a vacation, sometimes another lead writer will take over from Raw. And so, you know, it's such a different type of vibe now, and especially with the brands kind of merging in this weird mashup thing that they're doing right now. So it's different now, but, it's not productive, you know.
We also, on this pay-per-view, saw Rey Mysterio lose his World Heavyweight title to Booker T, and I just wanted to ask, was that always the plan, to have Rey lose at this pay-per-view?
No.
It was not, and what was the original plan for him to lose it to? And overall, what were reactions like to his title run?
Vince McMahon decided within like the weekend of WrestleMania that it was going to be Rey winning in the triple threat match with Randy Orton and Kurt Angle at WrestleMania 22 in Chicago. It really came down. There was people that were for it, people that were against it. I was for it. Pat Patterson was for it. Greeny was for Randy Orton. Dusty Rhodes was for Randy Orton. And I'm sure there's a lot of other guys that were for different people, and I shouldn't be outing them like this. But, you know, looking back, maybe the worst thing for Rey was to win the title, because when he was champion, it really – Vince just buried him. And he really wanted us to know that he was going to acquiesce and let us have Rey as champ. But on this day, he was going to lose it, and he was going to budge from it. And we said, okay. And every week he tried to prove to us that Rey couldn't draw his champion and the fans wouldn't buy it. And how could they, based on the creative laid out, because Vince saw it that way. And we couldn't do anything more than submit our ideas, and then Vince would do what he wanted with them or without them. And ultimately Vince did different stuff than what we had hoped to do, for Rey's world title run. And, we were able to push it back, and we're hopeful that it would buy us some time to establish Rey as a real champion, and that was an underdog but always looked good in the end, would outwit the challenger, or would, you know, outrun him or out, you know, high fly him. But at the end of the day, he really didn't do any of that stuff and just looked really bad. So we ultimately were able to extend it by a little bit. Originally, JBL was going to take the title from him, I believe, in May of 2006, but then JBL, I believe, got injured in a match at the pay-per-view. Was it Judgment Night 2006, maybe?
Yeah.
And that, I think, ultimately, that was it for JBL for a while, for like over a year or two, and we thought he was just done, like retired. And I think he did, too. I mean, his back was just thrashed. So we had to then, you know, like everything the whole summer was just doomed. So we had to, you know, figure out, okay, well, who's going to do that and what's going to happen? And I've been working on kind of doing a King of the Ring concept because I wanted to fill TV time, and I always loved the King of the Ring. I didn't like necessarily all the quality of the tournaments and stuff, but I thought it'd be kind of nice to reboot it and bring it back. And, you know, we in that, I think it was May, June, around then, and so I had a lot of ideas that I was throwing out there, whether it was kind of doing the old school All Japan carnival tournament where it was points based and stuff, but I knew that was really not realistic for what Vince would like and what he'd like to see on his TV, but I included it with one of my pitches. And then another pitch was to just to do a, you know, straight up eight man. So we had a round robin, like the All Japan style, and then you had, you know, a straight up old school, like eight man type tournament. So that's what we went with. And, Booker was the guy that was going to win it. And then we felt like, well, that makes him automatically the number one contender because he cleaned out the entire roster basically by the end of that. And that, so that naturally, and then he just, he went from Booker T to King Booker, and this transformation was tremendous. I mean, he just owned that role. He was tremendous on the mic, and then, you know, we started to realize, well, we could really have some interesting stuff if we built a little alliance with him and Regal and Fit and had these two guys from the United Kingdom kind of as his muscle. And, you know, with Charmel and Regal being dapper and stuff and Fit kind of be the muscle, I just thought it would be interesting, and everyone did. It wasn't my idea on that end. It was a collaborative thing. But Booker just ran with it and was tremendous. And ultimately we went into that direction, and Ray lost it at the Bash to him. And by then everyone was just relieved for Ray. You know, it was kind of like he wanted that chapter to end for him.
Just as you bring that up, what was the time period like in terms of the Booker Batista fight that they had? Because it was filming the SummerSlam commercial. Had that just happened prior to this pay-per-view?
I have a feeling that happened late June.
All right.
Late June, out in L.A., and we weren't there, but, you know, that second that thing went down, everyone knew about it, and I think in the entire universe. So, you know, we had heard about it, and as many people know, that was one of those really weird moments where Vince kind of was like possessed by Bill Watts, and it really felt like, well, if my guy isn't a kick-ass, legit badass dude, then he's not my guy. And you'll see a direct correlation with how Batista was presented from about that time period to, God, a 3 or 4 month run there where he just wasn't utilized really to the best of his abilities. Vince just was really lukewarm on him because, you know, as the story goes, Booker dropped him. They had a little dispute while shooting this spread in the back of a mansion where, you know, the divas were in bikinis. You had all the boys there, and it was like a pool party type vibe, and they crossed paths, and they had some problems before that, and Booker dropped him.
And you can follow Court Bauer on Twitter at Court Bauer, CourtBauer. And some interesting thoughts of what was conceived versus what was the original idea of the Punjabi prison match.
This is certainly no exploding death match, exploding table death match.
There were no explosions
at
all. So at this point, let's take a stroll back to the loft from that night, Way, where we had Dave Meltzer on the show. And here's a brief chat with Dan Lavransky, Jason Agnew, and Dave Meltzer just moments after the Great American Bash concluded, featuring the Punjabi prison match.
Now, as we like to do every Sunday night, we're going to talk to Dave Meltzer, the editor of the Wrestling Observer newsletter. Dave, I'm laughing already. I don't know what to make of that pay-per-view tonight. That was one of the craziest pay-per-views I think I've ever seen in my life.
I don't know what you mean by that. I just thought it was just, there it was, then it's over, now I don't remember anything.
Well, you know, The up until the cage match, the prison match, it was pretty good in ring, but there's no storylines attached, so there's nothing to remember. It was just stuff thrown together.
Yeah, I thought the Matt Hardy match was real good, but I mean, you're
there's
right.
No, it
was
story. Like, there's no story.
I didn't even know that match until literally Matt Hardy went to the ring, and
yep.
I'm going, what's he doing here?
Yep.
And I mean, and I got the lineup from someone the morning of the show.
And
it was super crazy.
Well, that's what SmackDown led us to believe it would be super crazy.
I know, I was actually told.
Oh, well, there you go.
So, I mean, it's you know, I think it was a change. I think it was to punish Matt Hardy. Although I don't know that for sure, I'm pretty sure. And, you know, it was really weird. I mean, just how they handled everything. The angle to get the Great Khali out of that match had to be the worst
Ridiculous.
Angle I've ever seen.
Ridiculous.
I mean, it was like they had they couldn't spend 2 seconds to come up with something. And then the Bobby Lashley thing, just don't you think it just made him look terrible?
It was awful. It was ridiculous. Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about the Lashley and Cali stuff first here, and give us a little bit of the backstory on that. It was obviously some sort of fallout from their drug tests.
It wasn't the drug test.
Okay.
In both cases, they got bad livers.
Right.
Which, you know, you can speculate, and I, you know, everyone's going to speculate the same thing, and more likely than not, they're going to be right. But, you know, you had two guys with bad livers, and, you know, with Lashley, they've known for a couple weeks.
Okay.
And if you're asking me why they picked 2 days before the pay-per-view instead of the day after the pay-per-view, I have no idea.
That's a great question. If this had been a Raw pay-per-view and it was one of their top guys in one of the more important matches, you can bet it wouldn't have happened until after the pay-per-view.
Well, I think the part of it is that the degree of damage to the liver might have been more than they were willing to risk.
Right.
You know, because you got to remember, they're in a situation now where they know. So when you know when you put someone in and something bad happens, it's kind of like, you know, the legal possibilities aren't good for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like before there was like, how would we have known? You know what I mean?
Right.
How do we know Eddie? And legitimately, how did we know Eddie Guerrero had a bad heart? You know what I mean? We didn't know. No one knew. But we knew Bobby Lashley had a bad liver, and we still put him in the ring. So I think that might be some of the...
That's fair enough.
You know, I mean, but with Bobby Lashley, I think that... I don't know why they did what they did, because it just made him look bad. With Kali, obviously, they still want to save him.
Well, I want to know what's going to happen on SmackDown this week, because they made him still look like he came out during that match. What are they just going to say on SmackDown? He disappeared?
I don't know. Maybe they'll just have him walk around and do things and not do matches.
Yeah.
I don't know how they're going to handle it. I was told he's on ice now, but you know, I mean, if he doesn't wrestle, he can still show up. And the same with Lashley, they can still show up at the TVs.
I have a feeling that's what's going to happen, because there's no way, I don't know how you'd explain Cali just disappearing after he came out tonight and got involved, although I don't even know why he came out during the cage match. He didn't do anything.
I guess just to keep the thing alive. I think the other thing is with his health the way it was, realistically, I watched that cage match. You know, I thought the cage match was horrible, but the thought in my head, especially as that thing was going on, was, can you imagine how bad that match would have been with Kali in it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it would have been bad. It would have been bad regardless, Dave, because it was the most convoluted piece of crap I've ever seen in my life.
I know, but I mean, it's like Big Show's 1,000 times the... I mean, Kali, it would have been one of the all-time stinkers of a match instead of just,
it's on its way right now, Dave. It was Stink City, man.
What a finish, too.
It was ridiculous. The way it was booked with the double cage, the stupid four-door concept, absolutely ridiculous.
But I mean, you know, between that and then... And then trying to, like, get it over, like, The Undertaker just accomplished something and pulled, like, this thing out when it was, you know... They fell through this cardboard cage.
And what about your ECW champion made to look like a complete wussy, crying in the ring?
The Extreme Champion goes in the ring and he's practically
crying. He's crying at the beginning and the end of the match. Ridiculous.
I know.
What about the Batista thing? That made no sense to me too. Why was that a lame anticlimactic DQ finish? What was that? What were they trying to do there?
The only thing I can think of is that they're going to rematch them on television and Batista will beat him on television. Now, if that doesn't happen, then your guess is as good as mine, because no one told me they're going to do that. I'm just, when it was over, I'm trying to come up with ideas, because obviously Batista and Booker are going to be at SummerSlam, so you would think Batista would get a win. Maybe, I would say maybe they're trying to protect Kennedy, but for what? And he'd already lost to Matt Hardy, so it's not that big of a deal. So I'm just guessing it's to set up a rematch, but time will tell.
I don't see the point of that. I don't see why he couldn't have just beaten Kennedy, you know, like most of us thought. Give it a fairly quick win. You keep Batista strong. He moves on to the program with Booker.
Well, maybe they thought people knew it. And I don't know. I don't know. A lot of this show was very weird. Another thing is on the in the Regal Finley match, I just thought the announcers killed the match because they weren't talking about the match.
No, and well, I knew that match would be good, but I also knew it would suck because I knew that the Leprechaun stuff would wreck it. And
Leprechaun wrecked it, and also the fact is you had two heels.
Yes,
and the crowd
into that's it. The crowd didn't know who to cheer for. Absolutely,
it's very interesting to hear their thoughts. Way the night of,
yeah,
the Punjabi prison match.
Not too different from how I thought.
Do you remember calling Dave that night?
Nope.
the July 23rd, 2006 phone call?
I do not remember, because all when I used to call screen for the law, all of our conversations would basically consist of, hi, Dave, you're up next. Okay. That would be it.
Short and to the point.
Yeah.
All right. I think it's time to head over to feedback right now, and we'll start things off with Zach Volk. I have to admit that WWE had me intrigued as to what a Punjabi prison match would look like. When I saw the final product, I couldn't help but think, how did this ever make it past the spitballing stage? Vince, with his love for monsters, was probably thinking he would make the Punjabi prison match the 2000s version of the casket match concept. They even released a shitty toy for this gimmick. I haven't seen this in years, but I don't believe they took Kali out of the match until during the actual event. I'm sure you two will remind us better, but I seem to recall Big Show being announced as a replacement under some ridiculous scenario. Having Show instead of Kali had to improve the quality of the match because Kali could do so little. Kali must have the shittiest knees ever. They're so shitty, they made his wrestling ability seem less terrible. I feel bad this man has to perform work that prevents him from spending his days sitting in a large chair. During this period, having the brand split led to some really watered-down cards, especially for the SmackDown shows. Certainly not a great show, except I remember the Finlay Regal match being really enjoyable. I give it a 4.5 out of 10 with an extra half point because Kali got to sit in the back and chill out and not mess up his knees even more working a match on that abortion of a structure they called the Punjabi prison.
He did end up scaling the side of the cage.
Yeah, they cut him like scaling, but... Why? They had left when he started. I didn't know what his involvement was conducive to.
From Tom, I ended up going to this show live in Indianapolis.
Oh my goodness.
In the cheap seats. I really liked the opening tag match and seemed to be the only person in the building that enjoyed Regal and Finlay. The most vivid memories I have of this event are of other fans, both in line at the show and in the audience. For instance, the friend that I went to the show with and I seemed to be the only people we could find who knew about the elevated liver enzymes outbreak, and we had fun with it. Before the show began, we had convinced different people that the following men were replacing Kali and or Lashley: the Iron Sheik, Great Muda, Hulk Hogan, Kerry Von Erich, Dennis Rodman. I sat next to a family who had to have taken up 15 seats by themselves. Their youngest son, probably 5 or 6 years of age, sat directly next to me. When the dad asked me about the show and I informed him and his son that Bobby Lashley wouldn't be there and that I read it from the internet, the child got so upset that he stood up in his seat and yelled directly in my face, "The internet is fake!" The same child also chanted for Chusaki in the Funaki-Simon Dean dark match and got so excited during the Undertaker's entrance that he grabbed my arm and began crying.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Oh, I love kids.
Corey Ferreira. Ah, the WWE version of the Great American Bash, always known for being the shit event of the calendar year. Well, 2006 is no different, giving us several awful matches. The opening tag between Noble and Cash against Kendrick and London is a really good way to start off the show. Regal and Finlay is a solid match between two old-school guys who work a similar style. Helms and Hardy, also a solid match. After three solid to good matches, the show hits its rock-bottom point with the start of the Punjabi prison gimmick match with Big Show, which is bad, but I imagine it was going to be a whole lot worse with Kali in the match. God, this match was awful. What did WWE follow this piece of shit up with? But a brawn panties match with four women who are all terrible workers, though McCool did improve quite a bit as her career progressed, but she's awful. The Ray title reign ends here, to which I'm sure many people were happy about, and I'm sure they were happy seeing Booker finally win a world title in the WWE. Overall, a mixed event, with the first few matches being really good to the second half of the show, following the WWE tradition of having really bad Great American Bash events.
We go to Lee Chuck, who says, if I'm not mistaken, this is the 150th review away, so congratulations on your milestone. I did not realize
that. Neither of us knew that.
Well, we should do a retrospective, I suppose.
Yes.
Yeah, no, not really. All I remember from this show was the terrible Punjabi prison match. What was the match finish? Why did Kali and Daivari climb onto the cage towards the end of the match for no reason? I remember laughing out loud at how stupid the whole thing was. WWE's Great American Bash pay-per-views were an absolute joke. Punjabi prisons, Mordecai, Kenzo Suzuki, and Paul Bearer being murdered. It was actually the 2004 Great American Bash that had the most crap and would be quite a painful, entertaining review for you guys.
That 2004 show was 10 levels of worse than this show. That was a horrendous pay-per-view. Patrick McFadden. Before each of these reviews, I sit down and look up the event in question and rewatch it to refresh my memory. But for this one, I just can't do it. You take a great Kali-Taker match with a stipulation that is very specific to Kali, subtract Kali and add in Big Show? Yes, I pass. It was brutal, and whenever I think of Great American Bash, I don't think about Dusty Rhodes facing Tully Blanchard or the Four Horsemen in War Games. I think about that goddamn bamboo monstrosity. So thanks for that nightmarish image, WWE. The bigger issue I have with the show is yet another Rey Mysterio title defense where we're told over and over again by Cole that Rey is an underdog. Rey is small, see? And it's so crazy that he's the World Heavyweight Champion. Look how tiny he is. That big-ass gold belt looks adorable on him. If they can't treat their champion with respect, why would I look at him as anything but a fluke title holder, someone who's just holding the belt until a legitimate champion takes it? Even the most despicable heels were built up as legitimate competitors by the announcers, but for Rey, they went the opposite direction. They buried him over and over again, and there's only so much that I can sit through before I just give up. And ending the show with Chavo's interference just solidified the show as a 0 out of 10 for me, because you knew that Eddie would once again be the focal point of the inevitable Rey and Chavo feud.
We go to Alan Gaynor, who says, we have an Elimination Chamber pay-per-view, a Money in the Bank pay-per-view, and a Hell in a Cell one too. Why hasn't the Punjabi prison concept been spun off into its own event? I, for one, need closure on the Kali Jinder Mahal saga, and I'm waiting to plop down $50 to see it settled in a Punjabi prison. I assume the structure is now in the McMahon-Helmsley backyard, where Aurora Rose hangs off it like a jungle gym. As for the rest of the card, you've got to give the WWE credit, despite the fact that their roster was split into three different brands, and they lost one of the original competitors in three of the four biggest matches. They still put on a better pay-per-view than they do now sometimes with the brand split, all but erased.
I will disagree that I felt at this time period, I typically enjoyed SmackDown a lot more than Raw at this time period in 2006, so I thought the SmackDown shows actually held up a bit more than the single Raw pay-per-views at the time. But thanks for your feedback, everyone.
Are you saying that he enjoyed the show?
Yes. Okay. I was going back more to a point someone made earlier about when it came to the individual brand pay-per-views, that SmackDown was kind of the weaker of the two. But I found SmackDown, especially in 2006, was a fairly enjoyable show overall. Mm-hmm. I mean, you had your hits and misses like anything. So thank you, everyone. Thank you to Court Bauer for joining us. You can always listen to his stuff at MLW.com. You can follow him on Twitter. And that's going to bring us to a close, everyone. A big thank you to Dave Meltzer, who probably has no idea he was on this week's show. Or the Big Show, who has definitely not an idea, unless he's listening every week, which he could be.
You don't find the clip.
I wonder what his answer would be like today if they asked him over the Punjabi prison.
I imagine pretty much
probably
the same.
A highlight for him. Maybe. We'll see. Next week, Wei, we're back with another review. I had picked this one, so now it is your choice, Wei. It's like you get to be the general manager of Review Away.
Yes. Well, we have reviewed a lot of WWE shows over the past month or 2 months.
Much.
And, with 3-hour Raws coming up, I feel like I'm a bit oversaturated with
overdosing
my WWE. So let's go back to WCW, in specific, WCW of 1999. And we'll do a show that takes place during the summer. That's Road Wild.
Road Wild.
Road Wild 1999, featuring a main event of Kevin Nash versus Hulk Hogan in a retirement match for the WCW World Heavyweight Championship.
Whoa, retirement match?
Retirement.
We're going to see one of these men in their last match ever.
Never to be seen again.
Wow.
That date. As well, on the undercard, Dennis Rodman.
What?
Versus Randy Savage. Two legends. Two in-ring legends. In-ring legends. As well, our very first show, our world champion from this event makes a previous appearance, Rey Mysterio Jr., teams with Billy Kidman and Eddie Guerrero, taking on Vampiro and the Insane Clown Posse.
Oh my God.
Tons to look forward to if you're a fan of WCW or if you're not a fan. Watch.
All right. Well, we're going to be posting up a thread so you can leave your feedback there. Road Wild 1999. From somewhere in South Dakota.
Sturgis.
Yeah, that's
and
where they
the
ran.
Sturgis.
The brilliant idea for WCW to run shows where they did not charge money for people to attend.
We're going
to
make
no live gate on this at all and believed they just make money on pay-per-view. We'll find out if they did. That's coming up next week. In the meantime, tons of stuff, Wei. So much to talk about. We have our review of Raw from this past Monday, recapping Raw 1000. a real fun podcast. You're listening to this. MMA Report, that airs every Thursday at tsn.ca/MMA, and I'm going to get it its own feed on Stitcher. It's I want to have a go-to place for everyone for that, because it's tough to find sometimes.
Mm-hmm. So,
anyway, and then we're back on Friday with Review and Impact. Law Sunday. No UFC pay-per-view, though.
No UFC. Weekend. So what are you going to talk about on the MMA Report?
Well, I'm going to be joined by Dr. Margaret Goodman from VADA, mm-hmm. and we're going to be talking drug testing and testosterone replacement therapy, and who knows who else will join me. Stuff always happens. There's always stuff to talk about. Mm-hmm. There's an all-women's card on Saturday, too. Invicta Fighting Championships, called by Moro Ranallo, Julie Kedzie, and King Mo.
Any bra and panties matches on
no that card? No bra and panties match that I am aware of right now. Maybe a four-way MMA bra and panties match.
Yeah.
A sports bra and panties match, maybe, the MMA tie-in and board shorts. All right. That's going to wrap us up, folks. If you're not following us on Tout yet, what are you doing? Tout.com/lawradio. Twitter, at way0937, at lawradio, liveaudiowrestling.com. Subscribe on iTunes to Live Audio Wrestling. Is there anything else, Way? Do you have Instagram? Do you have a draw something?
I do. I've stopped responding.
You stopped playing
though.
With me. It's been your move for like 3 months.
I mean, I'm sorry. There are just so many. It's very time-consuming because I like to put a lot of effort in my drawings.
That Vader picture is the best draw something photo I've seen.
Oh, thank you.
It's fantastic.
But the thing about draw something is that there's no end. There's no conclusion.
No.
How do you win?
That's one of the annoying parts.
Yeah.
I just downloaded this app on my BlackBerry Playbook. It's like Bobble Buster or some shit, and I'm on like level 33 right now. It never ends.
Bobble Buster.
Yeah, I'll find out the exact name.
Bubble Mania?
Really
Bubble Mania?
That might be. Is it a? Oh. You have 27 updates to make on your apps. No, it's a different game, but I think it's the exact same concept. I played it like nonstop for 4 days last week.
Temple Run, are you a fan?
I have not got Temple Run
yet.
You
gotta get Temple Run.
Is it really addictive? Does it cost something?
Awesome. No.
Oh, it's free. Fuck. The free apps, I get really addictive to stuff. Like, I want to play ping pong right now after we just played.
Yeah.
It's really addictive.
We'll play again and we'll tout it.
Okay, we're going to leave a song to go out. You know what? I heard this crazy... I'm a big fan of mashups. I download a lot of mashups to put on my iPod. And this one may not be the best, but I really love it. And it's called it's Wonderback with Jay-Z and Oasis coming together. So let's hear this. It's Wonderback mashup, which is... how can I tie this in?
What are the songs? Wonderwall and what's the Jay-Z song?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know off the top of my head.
Oh, this one. Yeah, I know.
Yeah. This makes sense, right?
Yeah.
And there's some little kid saying something. All right. We'll be Wonder Back on Friday.
That's awful.
Fuck, this is going to be a long one, man.
Ladies and gentlemen, H to the SO. I want to thank everybody there for their purchase. Surely appreciate it. But you about to witness is my thoughts.
Just my thoughts, man.
Right or wrong.
There are many things that I would like to say to you.
You ever felt like this? Vibe with me.
Walk with it, nigga.
Vibe with me. Yo. Gather round, hustlers, that's if you're still living. And get on down to that old shit rhythm. It's a couple of jewels to help you get through your bit in prison. A ribbon in the sky, keep your head high. Ah, young Vito, voice of the young people. Mouthpiece for hustlers, I'm back, motherfuckers. Your reign on the top was shorter than leprechauns. You can't fuck with hoes, what type of ex you're on? I got great lawyers for cops who dress warm. Charges don't stick, they do, he's Teflon. Sexy for jail like a right said bread. I'm not joking, I'm getting back my bread. Mr. District Attorney, I'm not sure if they told you I'm on TV every day. Where the fuck could I go to? Plus, hold, don't run, hold, stand and fight. Hold's a soldier, hold, been fighting all this life. So, what could you do to me? It's not new to me, sue me, fuck you. What's a couple dollars to me?
but you will respect me. Simple as that. Oh, I got no problem going back. I'm representing for the seat where Rosa Parks sat. Yeah, Malcolm X was shot. Yeah, Martin Luther was popping. So off we go. Let the trumpets blow. And hold on, because the driver of the mission is a pro. The ruler's back. Somebody should have told him I'm a fucking rock star.